enjoyment of the holiday or you've not got something which you should have got, often with a package holiday, you're entitled to some compensation or entitled to a reduction in the price. That may well be the case here. If we'd had this call earlier in the night, I could have explored it a bit more with you, but that's what you need to do. If you're still not in a good place with this time next week, call me back so we've got more time to explore it. But in the meantime, try those steps first. Thank you very much for your calls, texts and tweets this evening. That's it from me, consumer lawyer Dean Dunham. A quick reminder that the advice offered in this hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'll be back next Sunday, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. But in the meantime, if you missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on both Global Player and the LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1 on LBC, it's Richard Spur, but next, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will talk about the challenge of educating certain demographics of children and why some fall behind and not others. There's a supposed peace summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin coming, but is there much that can come from it? Another heat wave is on the way. We'll get an update on the weather prospects. We'll talk about the latest from the war in Gaza and what the Israelis are proposing now. And check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, can you be an MP and a landlord and a business person and a television celebrity? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Israel says it expects to complete a new offensive against Hamas in Gaza fairly quickly. The claims come from Benjamin Netanyahu, while the United Nations Security Council has been hearing new demands for an end to the suffering in the territory. The Israeli Prime Minister says his country has no choice but to complete the job against Hamas and rescue the remaining hostages. But Professor David Tal, who's an expert on Israeli security, has told LBC there is little detail.
It's more, I would say, a plan of intention rather than an actual plan of action for various reasons. And it looks like, at least at this stage, that it's aimed to serve more as a threat and a tool of pressure rather than actual act to be carried out, at least within the short-term time.
A wildfire has broken out in Edinburgh on the historic hill known as Arthur's Seat. Police are advising people to avoid the area, which is popular with walkers and tourists. On Saturday, emergency crews were dealing with a different wildfire in Dorset. Dr. Chloe Brimacombe is a climate scientist.
So obviously there's not a heat wave in Scotland right now, but we are seeing these dry conditions and these warm conditions and these wind speeds. And we saw a wildfire near Edinburgh back in July. So these are conditions that we're seeing growing in countries where we might not have seen that risk being really prevalent before.
The White House says it's working on creating a meeting between Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky for talks on ending the war in Ukraine. European allies have warned Kyiv can't be left out of Friday's summit involving Donald Trump and the Russian president. 435 migrants arrived in the UK on Saturday after crossing the English Channel in seven small boats. It means more than 800 people landed on the south coast during last week. And in sport, Crystal Palace have beaten the Premier League champions Liverpool 3-2 on penalties to win the Community Shield. They lifted the trophy at Wembley after winning the FA Cup there in May, and both sets of fans admitted the Londoners deserved it.
To be fair, I've got to be honest with you, Palace were by far the best team in the second half. Liverpool never turned up. It was like a practice game for us. Like,
brilliant, yeah, that's all you can say. I don't think anybody expected us to win, did they? And there we are, all those multi-million pound footballers, and we play very well, Palace.
LBC weather, mostly clear overnight with some mist and fog patches developing. Cloudier in the north, though, with rain moving across Northern Ireland, Scotland and parts of the far north of England. We'll see a low of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good Good evening. Labour has warned the government will not be trusted on renters' rights after it emerged that members of parliament rake in at least £830,000 a year in rent. 83 members of parliament earn a minimum of £10,000 from renting their properties. That's according to the latest register of interests. And Keir Starmer's party leads the pack of mostly residential landlords. Let's talk about this with Zoe Grunwald. Zoe is the Westminster editor at The Lead and a freelance political journalist and broadcaster. Good evening, Zoe.
Good evening, Nick.
Does it matter what outside sources of income MPs have got as long as it doesn't affect their work on our behalf?
I think it does matter because, I mean, there's a few things here. I mean, particularly on earning money from being a landlord. You know, the housing crisis is one of the kind of defining issues in modern Britain today. You know, it's so horrifically dysfunctional. Rents are extremely high. You know, it's now an average of £2,712 a month in London and £1,365 across the rest of the UK. We know rents have outstripped wages. We know that there are not enough houses built. Half of private renters have no savings, and the balance of power has been tipped in favour of the landlords for a long time. And it matters because people need to believe that this government, as it says it has, is going to reform the rental sector, it's going to reform our ability to build in this country. But if you are a landlord, whether you like it or not, you are earning money from that broken system. You know, you're not a neutral observer. For you, that property is a commodity, and they're profiting from that broken system. And I think, you know, it matters in terms of perception, but it also is a clear conflict of interest. And I think particularly for this Labour government, who have staked so much in being able to build to get this country back to growth, I think they need to think really carefully about whether, you know, I mean, it's astonishing that the homelessness minister was a landlord, but I think particularly, you know, not having that kind of conflict of interest amongst its MPs is incredibly important.
Yes, I mean, some people say that, you know, what we actually really need in this country is MPs to be business people because, you know, business people know how to run things and that's what would be best for the country. Wouldn't somebody who is a landlord have an inside, sort of an insider's view that would be unavailable to those that don't of how to, of what is wrong with and how to fix the system?
But if you are a landlord, I mean, what you are doing is profiting from that system, right? So even if you can see that there is an imbalance of power, that there's some things are unfair, obviously you have an interest in ensuring that you maintain your wealth. So, and that, you know, a lot of that wealth has been based on the fact that we simply didn't build enough houses, but also creating a system which is precarious for a lot of renters. Actually, I'd argue it'd be far better if you had a renter in that position, because they would understand exactly what it's like to be a renter in this country, to know how that instability and that threat of being evicted at any time without any fault, and knowing how much you spend on average on your rent compared to your wages or saving money or anything like that. I think arguably that is much more important in kind of understanding the issues people are dealing with across the country. You know, this really is, you know, the housing shortage is one of the reasons our economy just simply doesn't function properly. I mean, if you look at, you know, younger generations, they're putting off having children, they're moving back in with their parents, they're living with mounting debt. You know, half of renters in this country have no savings. And then things like poor physical health and mental health. I mean, a lot of that is linked to our housing as well. So these things are really hard, I think, for if you are a person with multiple properties and you own your own home. It is going to be more difficult for you to understand that and understand the impact of that.
But it's also more difficult if you're earning £93,000 a year with subsidised food and subsidised travel and subsidised rent and £250,000 in expenses, which is the case of all MPs. It's difficult for them to, you know, relate to somebody who is going to a food bank to put food on their plate.
That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, we should be all thinking about how we can make Parliament much more representative. But I think, you know, there is a really key point there, which is that I don't think second jobs are harmless. I think, you know, MPs are entrusted by their constituents with a huge amount of responsibility. And the idea that you can do that job that is so important, yet have another job on the side, you know, and be able to give both jobs 100%. And, you know, this is the same with being a landlord. A lot of landlords, you know, some landlords are very, you know, they do a lot of the work themselves. But a lot of landlords, for them, it is quite a passive income. I mean, you know, I think both being a landlord and an MP requires higher standards than possibly some on the other side of treating it. So I think, you know, especially for being an MP, it's really, really important that that is where your time and effort is going to. And if you look at someone like Nigel Farage, right, he made almost £400,000 last year selling gold and hosting a TV show. You know, it's amazing that these people...
Yes, sorry to interrupt, but he is an outlier. I mean, there are MPs who do continue with their business, whatever it might be, but surely that's different. You know, attending a business takes your time and your effort and so on, but being a landlord might take no time at all. You just leave it in the hands of a property agent and they do everything, and all you do is see the money appear in your bank account at the end of the month.
And I think the issue there is the perception, because a lot of people know that the housing system in this country is completely dysfunctional. It doesn't work. It's the root of many of our issues. And if you have someone who is just, you know, secondhand profiting from that, who's supposed to be in charge of housing policy, and then you hear about these stories, you know, for example, like the homelessness minister who, you know, moved tenants on from her property and then put up the rent, or you get the Labour MP who had several, you know, his property portfolio was full of mouldy substandard homes. That does terrible things for public confidence in that government's ability to fix the system. You know, you can see how they're profiting from it. It feels like empty words. And I think we have to remember, we are at a time where confidence in government is at a record low. In the most recent survey, almost half of Britons said they never trust the government, no matter what stripe it is, to prioritise the national interest. And we know we're pushing back on populism at the minute. I think it's vitally important that this government takes standards really, really seriously. And I think that means showing the public that MPs are putting their job as MPs first.
But are we getting to a place where no one who wishes to become an MP can have any outside interests at all? And isn't that unreasonable to forgo all outside earnings for a very unstable and precarious temporary job?
I think that's a really good point. And, you know, there are some people who say maybe actually the answer is to pay MPs more, which I think, you know, you already, as you listed before, they have, you know, generous salaries already, pensions, expenses, you know, all those kind of things. But it is a conversation worth having. You know, how can we encourage MPs to prioritise their work as constituent MPs? And I think it's something that needs to be thought about, because and you know, there is also an argument that, for example, isn't it great to have people who were doctors, right, presiding over health policy or being in a health and social care select committee? You know, that lived experience is, I would argue, very, very important. But I think once you become an MP, that job is so, you know, there's so much power bestowed on you. There's so, you know, you've got all the interests of your constituents. It really does make sense for that to be your number one priority. And of course, there might be exceptions. You know, I think Keir Starmer said he wanted to ban most second jobs and has now actually just changed the wording around, you know, lobbying and consulting. But I think that needs to be looked at again carefully, because clearly what you have is not only the danger that people, you know, MPs aren't concentrating on their day job or the perception element, but you have the potential for scandal when things like this happen. For example, the homelessness minister, you know, that really undermines Labour's promise on renters reform. And at a time where political confidence is really low, you just can't afford to have that kind of, you know, that confidence undermined any further. So I think, you know, I completely understand the point, but I think we should be pushing for a parliament with higher standards that expects more from its parliamentarians. And maybe that is an equal amount of carrot and stick.
Don't Labour get any credit, though, for their own renters reform bill, which will potentially harm the interests of the MPs that we're talking about?
The renters reform bill is a really important piece of legislation. And I think it's, you know, banning Section 21 no-fault evictions is hugely important and will change a lot of people's lives. You know, I mean, I don't want to over-egg, you know, all the issues in the housing market, especially for renters, will be fixed by this bill. But the fact that you could be evicted with no fault of your own, and people were saying, you know, I just asked my landlord for a new boiler and I got served with a Section 21. I mean, it stops people from being able to put down roots. It plunges people into all sorts of financial difficulty. That is a really important thing. So, yes, they should get credit for pushing that through. But the reason it's taken so long to reform the rental sector is because there is such a heavy influence of the landlord lobby in Parliament. You know, we know that many, many MPs are landlords. We know that there are influential groups that lobby parliamentarians. You know, they put on events at Labour Party and Conservative Party conference, trying to break through that to be able to get a much fairer system for both tenants and landlords. is really important. And Labour have done a good job so far. But things like this, having your homelessness minister being a landlord and then using a loophole in the legislation that's not yet passed to move on her tenants, you know, those are the kind of things that undermine that confidence and make people wonder whether they're really serious about renters reform. And I think that is just a very unwelcome distraction and shouldn't have been allowed to happen in the first place.
Yes, it was an odd set of circumstances, but I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that she broke the law in any way or that
she
was acting in bad faith. What she did was within the law. It's that the Labour Party themselves are in the process of changing the law. And, of course,
exactly.
The Tories said that they were going to do this.
Mm.
And more Tories have been landlords under the previous 14 years of Conservative rule than Labour.
Mm.
And the Conservative landlords, tried to gut the Tories' renters' reform bill. Is there any evidence that Labour landlords are acting to water down Labour's renters' rights bill?
I don't think so. And, you know, it should be said, and you're absolutely right, you know, Ali didn't break any laws. The issue is that, of course, the legislation that her department is spearheading would have made that sort of practice illegal. So that is where I think that the claims of hypocrisy lie. I don't think there's any evidence. I mean, I think Labour is really serious about reforming the rental market, and I think they are serious about reforming the housing sector. But, you know, you have to understand how embedded this landlord lobby is. And of course, if you are profiting from that kind of system, it does raise issues about, you know, whether there are conflicts of interest and whether things would move as quickly as if you had, you know, people who didn't have a kind of direct stake in it being in the status quo from being there. But, you know, I take your point. And I think it is important to say that the Labour government have done more on this than the Conservatives, and they should get credit for that. But I just think these kind of things are unwelcome distractions and, you know, unfortunately undo a lot of the good optics they had about actually pushing that legislation forward.
Yeah, but it's more than optics, isn't it? I mean, doesn't the very fact that the department that Rushanara Ali was leading in order was you know, part of enacting this renters reform bill, it which would have made what she did illegal.
Mm.
I mean, doesn't that rather puncture the balloon of the idea that there is hypocrisy here? Because there isn't. They're acting in a way that is against their own interests in order to help people who we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is absolutely the case that I think the question is all these things. That particular thing about a landlord moving out tenants, saying they're putting their property up for sale, and then you know, putting it back on the market and putting up an increased rent. That is a practice that has been well documented and is kind of like a loophole for landlords to be able to do, actually get more money. There isn't a suggestion necessarily that Ali was doing that, as you say, was acting in those. It's just that particular practice was a part of this legislation that had been hotly debated. And it kind of had the feeling of, you know, is she trying to be able to do that before the legislation comes in? You know, this is kind of do as I say, not as I do. And I think that is the concern here.
Yeah, it wasn't a good look for the homelessness minister to resign over a homelessness issue after the anti-corruption minister resigned over an alleged corruption issue.
Mm.
Yeah, the optics
precisely
weren't very good with that. You know, some MPs become landlords accidentally, don't they? Their parents may die, or they own their own property in a far-flung part of the nation, and then they have to, because they're MPs, they have to, you know, relocate to London. And so they could sell, or they might be more minded to rent. They don't set out to be a landlord, it just sort of works out that way. So how would you deal with that?
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, that is a conversation I've been having with people as well. And I think, you know, look, I don't think it's very likely that we're going to see a total ban on second jobs anytime soon. I also don't think it's likely that there's going to be a ban on MPs being landlords. But I think there is, of course, as you say, a difference between someone having a portfolio of properties and, you know, making a huge amount of money every month from those, or someone, for example, taking on the care of their, you know, their parent who passed away, their property, or, you know, having to deal with their own living arrangements. And I think you can have concessions for those, or you can think about a way that it is managed so it doesn't, you know, it isn't a case that you have vast waves of MPs profiting from what is a very, very broken housing market. But I think also just ensuring that your MPs are withholding the highest standards. So when you look at the Labour MP, whose name's escaped me now, but who had a property portfolio and had, you know, tenants complaining of rats, mold, threatened with eviction when they complained about, you know, the standard. That is exactly the sort of thing that you would hope this Labour leadership would be incredibly hot on, because it really does, you know, the Labour Party is supposed to be really, really strong on things like that. So I think there is, you know, there are questions around the rules about second jobs and landlords, which I think if this Labour government is really, really wants to reform standards, they should look at that. But I think more broadly, you need to be just very, very hot on the integrity of your members and making sure that everything they do is how you would want a Labour MP to be presenting.
But is the logical conclusion of what you're asking for MPs to have no other outside interest, to concentrate fully on being an MP, does that not lead us to a position in which only those who are independently wealthy can afford to be MPs?
So this is the question again about, you know, is it a case of paying MPs more? I there is clearly a difference between the MPs who are doctors and, you know, might put on a clinic a week or whatever, or MPs who are just profiting from a broken housing market. And I think, again, this is a question about what sort of second jobs, you know, would we tolerate? Do we think that can actually improve an MP's experience and improve an MP's knowledge, and which are actually just unwelcome distractions and potentially conflicts of interest? You know, I would argue being a doctor is not a conflict of interest as an MP in the same way that being a landlord is. You know, you are not profiting from one of the most dysfunctional sectors of our society. So I think, you know, a lot of this is a big debate and there are practicality issues around it. But I think in an ideal world, we would want our MPs to be totally focused on their constituents, on the legislation. And it's great, absolutely, if they have had, you know, if they're not all career politicians and they've had past lives where they've worked as doctors, nurses, you know, etc. So maybe there's a question of paying them properly. But I think we need to think about how Parliament is represented, making sure we have a vast experience there, but also that MPs are doing their day job and doing what it is their constituents expect them to.
Very good to talk to you, Zoe. Thanks very much for your time. Zoe Grunewald, Westminster editor at The Lead and a freelance political journalist and broadcaster. So what are your thoughts on that? Should we pay MPs more in order for them to do less outside work and more concentrating on their constituents? Perhaps we should allow them to continue to have outside work in order to not have to pay them more. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC.
Save this summer with Lidl Plus. Get 2 for £7 on burgers, jumbo sausages and more. And get 2 for £3.50 on our plant burgers, veggie sausages and more veggie classics. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this summer today.
18 plus TV only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
The ASA regulates UK ads across all media, including radio, to make sure they stick to the rules. You should be able to trust the ads you hear, whether you love them or hate them. So we're by your side and keeping our ears open, because every little helps. The ASA, keeping ads legal, decent, honest and truthful. Oh, yes.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So as you've heard, campaigners are calling for MPs to not be landlords or business people. Is that reasonable? Is it even achievable? I mean, the logical next step would be that no MP should own a business or work for a business, because theoretically that could influence their decisions too. But if they're acting in a way in which it looks as though their outside interests are not affecting their decisions, then is there any harm in allowing them to continue their outside work? 0345 6060 973. Bristol, Tiago.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Hi.
Your previous caller, I think, covered a lot of the conundrum here, because we, of course, don't want to create a world where MPs can only come from an exclusive part of society that can afford to do so. Mm. At the same time, I don't think it would be popular to be raising MP wages at any time in the near future, given how we're doing. I think it's a simple matter of principle and morality. Thinking about Jimmy Carter and how he divested from his own peanut farm when he became president of the USA, it shouldn't be hard for people to understand where, you know, there is a clear conflict of interest on the ability of represent people and what are they doing on private time.
Yes, there's a slight difference between, well, it's a gaping difference between the remuneration awarded to the President of the United States of America and an MP for, you know, a place in this country.
Well, I don't necessarily think it was about money. It was about the principle. It was about making sure that there was a clear message that his focus was his job. And I believe that there are, like it was pointed out, if an MP happened to be a doctor, we like to think, okay, that experience is valuable to us. At the same time, is fulfilling those hours in the hospital, ensuring that his constituents, so they, her constituents, have the best access to that MP at any given point. So I think it conflicts.
If an MP is a doctor, I mean, presumably, if they're a senior doctor...
Which is a good thing, yeah.
If they're a senior doctor, they will have a private practice. That brings up a conflict of interest as well, surely.
Well, I would imagine that if you are running for such a high public office that, you know, there is room for you to divest directly from things that you are involved in a day-to-day life, at least for, you know, your tenure as MP. And then if that's what you're going to do for term after term after term, it can be decided whether you continue to be invested on your own private interests or if you continue as a politician full-time. But I, at the same time, do think that, particularly when it comes to landlords, that it's a little bit like insider trading. Years ago, we had legislation not passed when it comes to rental properties. The word used on legislation was to be fit for human
habitation.
Habitation, and that was blocked by several landlords.
Tory MPs. Yeah.
Exactly. And which makes it shocking what happened now with...
Yes, I understand everything you're saying there, Tiago, but we're in a different place now. We don't have a Conservative government anymore, and this Labour government are pushing through the kind of policy that would impact directly the MPs that we're talking about, those who are landlords. It's not in their interest. So surely, you know, insider trading is something that you mentioned, and knowledge of what might happen to a market is one thing. Acting on it for your own profits, that's against the law. So surely being a landlord is not as bad as trying to restrict or impose your own take on whatever policy the government puts forward for landlords. If they're not doing that, then there is, in my eyes, is there really that much harm in being a landlord if you're not trying to bend the laws in your favour? But appreciate that, Tiago. Thanks for that. Camberley. Hello, Terry.
Hello there. Hi.
Terry.
Hi. Well, where to start? You've had some interesting conversations. The lady who was the homeless secretary, I think, she tried to sell her property. I believe she probably tried to sell it before the bill came in. Because she probably wanted to exit the market.
Well, as far as I'm aware, she tried to...
The renters,
well, perhaps. I don't know what her thinking was, but she didn't break any laws, and she put a house on the market for a certain amount.
I understand she did, because she let it as a... She was letting it as a home with multiple occupancy without a license.
Well, I'm not aware of that at all.
Well, that was reported in a number of different papers.
That's news to me, and I can't say that there's any suggestion that she was doing that. I'd have to see the evidence for it. But as far as I'm aware, she put a house on the market, couldn't sell it at the price that she wanted, decided to continue to rent it, and as most people would do, asked for the market price. She's not running a charity, and she didn't do anything wrong. I mean, if an MP hasn't done anything wrong, nothing that would attract the eyes of the law if they were just ordinary business people, should they be condemned for it when they become an MP? Because, I go back to my thought at the end of the conversation that I was having with Zoe Grunwald, that if we make it such that MPs can't have any outside interests, then it's a bit much to ask them to do a job that might only last, well, it might last a couple of months. Could be 5 years at most. Well, not at most, but it, they might expect to, at best, last, or at least last 5 years. Now, that's a pretty precarious and temporary job, a position to hold. And if you've dropped all of your other ways in which you can make money, well, then only the rich will apply for that job. And that wouldn't represent us better than the situation that we have at the moment. Let's see, texts and emails. Harry says, the MPs with rented properties, is it possible to check their voting record on housing or rent reform legislation? Well, yes, it is. Andrew in Stroud Green says, at the very least, MPs, landlords, rental income should be offset against any claims for London housing allowances and London hotel stays, as too many MPs' general expense claims should be offset against an MP's income from non-parliamentary work. Right, I think I understood that. Coming up, more of your thoughts on this on 0345 6060 973. Going to take the news immediately after that. UN ambassadors have condemned Israel's plan to take over Gaza City as, in their words, dangerous. I'll be joined by a Palestinian political analyst. Now, the headlines at 10:30. With Tim Daly.
Israel says it expects to complete a new offensive against Hamas in Gaza fairly quickly. The claims come from Benjamin Netanyahu, while the United Nations Security Council has been hearing new demands for an end to the suffering in the territory. Reform UK is dismissing the government's latest promise to deport foreign criminals directly after being given prison terms in England and Wales. It's also claiming the UK can never regain control over who it deports until it leaves the European Convention on Human Rights. And the White House says it's working on creating a meeting between Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky for talks on ending the war in Ukraine. European allies have warned Kyiv can't be left out of Friday's summit between Donald Trump and the Russian president. LBC weather, mostly clear overnight with some mist and fog patches. Cloudier in the north with rain moving across Northern Ireland, Scotland and parts of the far north of England with a low of 13 degrees.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
You've been humiliated beyond all belief.
Straight to the point.
Just pull the plug. There's no conversation to be had here.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
It's got worse. What is the problem they've got over there?
Listen on Global Player or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
With Little Plus Bakery Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free Little Bakery coupon on every shop. Download Little Plus and get at the Retail Industry Awards Supermarket of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability, ends 20th of August, full T's and C's apply, see little.co.uk/spin.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Canal Adventures in St Pancras.
That's a new one for us.
Oh, kids, cafe's this way.
Ooh, your heart out, Venice. This is lovely.
What's that? Yes, I have both captain hats for the boat ride.
Train back. So that was two pastries, one boat ride, and no tantrums. Result. Love this shot of them driving the boat. Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
Calling all little explorers. The hunt for squishmallows is on. Who will your little one find in their Happy Meal? Will they chill out with Cam on the beach? Or rock on with Hallie? Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 25th of August, from 11 a.m, Squishmallows comprise toys only. Subject to availability. Fair ordering policy applies.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So more of your thoughts on whether MPs can devote their full attention to their constituents and have a business as a landlord or any other kind of business on 0345 6060 973. More of your thoughts to come. But first, Benjamin Netanyahu says Hamas is refusing to lay down its weapons, and given their refusal to do so, Israel has no choice but to finish the job and complete the defeat of Hamas, he said. Let's talk about this with Ahmad Najjar. Ahmad is a Palestinian political analyst and playwright. Good evening, Ahmad.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
As far as you're aware, what is the situation in Gaza now?
Just to start by saying that I've just got some news, really, really sad news, that the killing of the journalist, the Al Jazeera journalist, Anas al-Sharif, who I have followed very, very closely, who just been killed an hour ago or even less. One of the main journalists in Gaza, and I followed very closely, he was reporting from the north of Gaza when no one actually dared to report from there because Israel was targeting journalists from there. He was threatened personally by, as he announced in his social media, by the Israeli army that they will kill him, and sadly they just managed to do that. So it's a very, very sad news for all of us, particularly us here that we follow him very closely. He reported on the Israeli war crimes and the genocide in Gaza. So the situation in Gaza right now, I spoke to my family this morning. Basically, the starvation is still going. The killing, that's been reported, more than 50 people have been killed in Gaza today. So the genocide is still going, really. But it's sort of like being escalated every now and then. And now, obviously, the announcement that Benjamin Netanyahu has said has obviously caused a lot of even more people are more scared of what could be coming up for them. But the question around whether he said that they want to control Gaza, or, and I find it very weird in a way. What they really mean by saying that, because they do already control all of Gaza. As we know, they control the food, the water, the fuel, the internet, where people are moving. And as we know, about three-quarters of Gaza are combat zone, so people cannot go into these areas. And so the entire population of Gaza are being pushed into one quarter of Gaza, which Gaza was already one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And the whole population now is being squashed into one quarter of it. So it's worse than concentration camps, really.
Well, for their part, the Israeli government denies that there's a genocide in Gaza, and Benjamin Netanyahu says that nobody is starving in Gaza, that Israel has let in more aid than any army has ever let in to an enemy territory in any war, and that images of starving children are fake.
Well, we have to mention that the one who said this is somebody who is committing a genocide and is wanted by the ICC for war crimes and crimes against humanity. So to me, it's like you're almost saying to me, Hitler denied he was killing Jews. So, or he ever committed crimes against other people. So that's what it sounds like. Israel has committed, and all international organizations in the world, all genocide experts have concluded that what Israel is doing in Gaza is a genocide. All the human rights organizations have concluded that Israel is using starvation as a weapon, is weaponizing food. And I can tell you what my family have eaten for the last week. I always now call my family every day in the morning, and the first thing I ask them, what did you have for in the day before? And the only thing they managed to get hold of is just rice or bread. So just to give you just that, like my dad, for the last 9 months, he haven't had a salad, just a salad. He hasn't had that. So that is, and that's obviously for whole my family. I'm just saying my dad, because my dad always likes to have for his lunch to have salad, and he hasn't had that for 9 months. So you know, here's the situation. My family is telling me that there's a starvation. All international organizations are telling us there is a starvation. Netanyahu, the genocidal guy, is telling us no, there is no starvation. So it's up to us who we believe, really.
Let's talk about the proposal to take over Gaza City. Because that's what Netanyahu said. He said that he wants to take over Gaza City and that that would be the best way to end the war speedily. What do you make of that?
I think he means that he wants to ethnically cleanse Gaza, and that he has said this repeatedly with his government. He has said it publicly, announced it, that they want to kick the population out of outside of Gaza, and they want to take Gaza. And the fact that he is going to get into the last bit of Gaza, the last quarter of Gaza, is going to result into tens of thousands of more people being killed. I think it's crazy when you know the geographical locations of Gaza and know where he is going to go and how densely is populated, and only by tents. So he's going to really fight and control over people who are living in tents. They have no sanitation system. They are being starved. I don't know what they want to control or what they are trying to do there. And he has been doing this for 2 years now almost. It hasn't worked, and it's not going to work. So the only way to really end the war, as he calls it, which we call it a genocide, as everybody else in the world calls it right now, is to really pull out and allow humanitarian aid to come in and allow life, allow some sort of normality to get into Gaza.
What do you make of the international response so far? I mean, it seems that most of the rest of the world is still disinclined to criticize Israel.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's a really shame that the world is okay to see starved children. It's a shame to see that more than 20,000 children have been slaughtered, and yet we are still not doing anything. It shows what type of world we're living in, and it's a very sad reality that we're living through. We never thought, neither of us thought, we would witness a televised genocide and do nothing about it. We, you know, history will remember that, and I say it with a very broken heart that I live in a time where we're witnessing genocide, and the world has allowed it to happen.
I mean, looking at the devastation in Gaza, is it possible to rebuild there, and would a rebuilt Gaza under the same kind of control that it's been in, be worth living in?
I mean, that's up to the people to decide who live there in Gaza. And the main thing right now is to stop the killing of innocent people, to hold Israel accountable. Let's not forget that Israel has been occupying the Palestine for more than 77 years. Palestinians have been oppressed for more than 77 years, and it's time now to end this oppression, to end this occupation. Let's see what also have a look at what's going on in the West Bank. The Jewish terrorist settlers' violence is unlimited and is protected by the Israeli army. So it is time to hold Israel accountable, and it's time to stop the madness that Israel is creating in the region. Israel is creating... This is creating a situation where nowhere is a staple, nowhere is going to flourish and become sort of suitable for people to live in. If we allow them to get away with what they've done in Gaza, they will move to the West Bank, they will move to Lebanon, they will move to Syria. So Israel is destabilizing the region and causing so much agony to the people in the region.
Ahmed, very good to hear from you. Thanks for that. Ahmed Najjar, Palestinian political analyst and playwright. Going to take a break, come back with your thoughts on second jobs and landlordism, if there is such a word, of MPs, whether they can do two things at the same time.
LBC, coming up next week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. As police fear a weekend of demos, the issue over the ethnicity of suspects becomes hotter than ever.
We do think that the guidance needs to change. change.
A call on the police from a Home Secretary feeling the heat. But are the police willing to listen? West Midlands Chief Constable Craig Guildford.
We produce loads of data, and of course we want to give as much information as possible, but we have to operate within the bounds of the rules of the law.
And as US Vice President J.D. Vance heads off to the Cotswolds, LBC's Henry Riley finds out what welcome's in store for him down on the farm.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
It's a chilled summer's day. The twins are splashing in the paddling pool while Mrs. Thing puts her feet up. She's proper chuffed, having saved money on a British Gas boiler service. It's like an MOT for your boiler. Just £79, reduced from £109. Bliss! Well, it was nice while it lasted. British Gas, taking care of things. Visit britishgas.co.uk to learn more and see full T's and C's. Sale ends 9th of September 2025. Offer available to new boiler service contract customers.
Because you never know what little pickles will get themselves into. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
So, where are we going?
You wanted to try something new? Well, we're here.
The Hyundai electrifying summer event.
I booked a test drive in the all-new Insta online. It's the 2025 World Electric Vehicle winner, and we save £500 if we order before the 31st of August.
Ooh, very stylish.
Oh, and it's Hyundai, by the way.
The Hyundai electrifying summer event. Are you in? 18 plus UK retail customers only. Excludes Motability. Registered by 30th of September. T's and C's apply.
Save this summer with Little Plus. Get 2 for £7 on burgers, jumbo sausages and more. And get 2 for £3.50 on our plant burgers, veggie sausages and more veggie classics. Download Little Plus and start saving this summer today.
18 plus TV only while stocks last. Terms apply. See little.co.uk/LBTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 60 60973.
So back to MPs' second jobs, and many of them are landlords, and Labour has been warned that the government will not be trusted on renters' rights after it emerged that MPs make at least £830,000 a year in rent. That's 83 members of Parliament who earn a minimum of £10,000 from renting properties, and it's probably a lot more than that, as there's not much that you can buy in a nice area, or rent, rather, in a nice area for just £10,000 a year. It'd be considerably more, probably three times that. Can they do two things at once? Should they be able to keep their business interests while being an MP, considering that being an MP is a pretty precarious and, by definition, temporary job? 0345 6060 973. East Grinstead. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Nick. Nice evening here in Sussex.
Ah, lovely.
Okay, yeah, it's good. I was listening to what you're saying, and I agree with many of the things you're saying earlier. I mean, one thing is, I'll stick to the main point I was telling your team on the phone earlier, which I'll start with that. I suspect the housing minister who resigned from her job, I expect that, you know, the reason that she, I believe, increased her the amount that the rental to £700 a month. I understand she hadn't.
No, it's true. I think it's two. I'm not totally sure about the details, but it was more than £700 a month for sure.
Was it? Okay. Well, I heard it as that when this story broke.
Maybe £2,700 a month. I can't remember exactly. Okay. Anyway, it was increased. Yes.
Okay. Well, the way I reacted to it when I first heard it was just, well, she's just come into contact, you know, she's looked at her electricity and her energy bills, you know, for this, she hasn't looked at them for a while. And I was saying to your team on the phone earlier, I mean, I listened to the broader conversation and I have a comment on that, but I mean, going back to 2022, my bills just became erratic. I know there were warnings from, say, the gas company to get your readings in early because prices were going to go up, which I did. But then there were a lot of erratic problems, and my bills were balmy. They just didn't make sense in their own terms. And I think a major gas company had its entire website crash. And since then, I've had problems with my billing. It's just been impossible. I've had to literally park it, and I'm going to return to it in full.
Yeah, well, in defence of this homelessness minister, she resigned because it was it was just too embarrassing that the homelessness minister was in effect making was turfing some of her tenants out. I mean, turfing is perhaps not the right word, but she didn't do anything that would really raise an eyebrow outside of Parliament. If she was just a landlord and it did some other work, then nobody would have said a word about it, because that's just how the market works. You ask what you can get. I mean, that for a home or any other product.
Yes, I agree. I agree with you. And you made a point earlier that, you know, I think the MPs as landlords, they actually get an income. I mean, however much I will sometimes disagree with what a politician is actually doing, you know, and sometimes, you know, you get really furious with what they're doing. But I do admire them always for doing what they do in the, for, you know, offering to try and do something in the first place, putting themselves up for the job. And I always think, you know, that when they're being a landlord, does give them a bit of a break. They've got to the point where they're a landlord and then they're saying, well, I can do something for society. I have some stability. That's not a bad thing. And the other thing is, of course, to say that I think that sometimes you can have set up these arguments with the presumption that they're, you know, something nefarious about in the first place, that they're exploiting people. I think a lot of landlords, and I've had lodgers in the past, you know, they're just looking for people to look after a place, get a little bit of cash for, keep it going, cover their bills, and they want someone that they got on with that they know will look after the place.
Yeah.
So it's not always an exploitive situation.
No, quite. All right, good to talk to you, Robert. Thanks for that. And this sum of £830,000 a year in rent that MPs bring in, I mean, that is an eye-wateringly large amount of money. But what it doesn't tell us is how much it costs the landlords to keep the property going, because they didn't make clear profit of £830,000 a year. That's just what they took in, surely. So, I mean, some of them, quite possibly, were losing money, you know, because the boiler goes, that's £5,000, and the roof needs replacing, that's £15,000, and there's a bit of subsidence, and that could be, well, pick a number and double it. So, you know, that we're not talking about people who are just sitting on a money-making machine. That you've got to shell out as a landlord as well. And it's difficult to know what your expenses are going to be in that regard in the future, because, you know, as any homeowner knows, anything can happen. 0345 6060 973. But having said all that, I mean, is it the principle of the thing? Should you, as an MP, should that be your complete and total concentration? Should that be your entire focus, the your constituents? Or, I mean, I've heard it said many times, you know, it'd be good if we were, as I said before, if we were run by business people who know how to run businesses. But business people tend to want to cling on to their business and not have to sell it just to take a job that might only last them 5 years. Claire in York, hello.
Hi. First off, I just wanted to point out that homeless minister who she actually offered to her tenants to stay in while she was selling her house. So she wasn't evicting them. She actually offered to let them stay while she was selling, but they chose to leave because of the uncertainty of it. But,
right.
But I mean, she has a, you know, she obviously didn't want to be a landlord anymore, and she has a right to have not wanted to be that. Unfortunately, she couldn't sell her house. So, I mean, park that aside. But what I feel is, from your guest, Zoe, it's just nitpicking. I mean, she was all about how wrong it was to have landlords without, and it took you to bring up the fact, well, actually, what Labour are doing, the evidence is important. It's what MPs are doing that is important. And the fact remains is that Labour are bringing in legislation which benefits the many and not the MPs, and I think that's proof of good character. You know, I'm much more interested in what MPs are doing, you know, to, that they're not being swayed by their own personal advantages, and that they are doing, bringing in legislation that is good for the many. Now Zoe said that she thinks it would be better if renters were MPs and that they were bringing in legislation, but surely that is the exact same problem as landlords. You only have one side of it then, and it is a very delicate balance. You don't want landlords to all sell up because of really stringent rules that make it impossible for them, because then rent, you know, there'll be shortages in renting and then there will be rent prices. So there is a delicate balance, and to just say, oh well, renters should be the ones making the rules, is the exact same problem as what we have now. And I think it's much more important about what Labour MPs are doing rather than whether they're a landlord or not.
Yes.
Which, by the way, takes up no time. It's not like having a business like many Tory MPs have that sit on in the Virgin Islands. You know, like one does, sits in the Virgin Islands with his law company. You know, so, you know, that's much more of a problem than a landlord.
Well, some landlords, of course, run their own business, and many would use some sort of property agent so that they don't have to bother with all of that,
yeah.
You know, waking up in the middle of the night to fix a leak and so on. And, of course, MPs are renters in many cases because they'll have to leave where their family home is. And
they will have children as well that are renting.
And acquire a place in London. I mean, I know they get subsidised for that, but renters, they remain. All right, good to talk to you, Claire. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. John says, perhaps it's jealousy, but why do MPs really get a second home allowance and choose to buy? I have to travel to work now and then, and I get expenses to be put up in a travel lodge or something for a couple of nights. I don't get enough to get a house, says John. And Alfred says, demand and supply. Are there shortages of people who want to be MPs? If not, let's reduce their salary. Camden, hello, Max.
Hi, Nick. Lovely to speak to you as always. But anyway, my point was this. Basically, why can't they be... There'll be an ethical minister who's much more thorough than it is now to check on MPs' outside interests, to the extent of what would happen with much lower down parts of life where you need references, you need this and that and the other. So why can't, say, if MPs have properties, that every year there's a review from the tenants that gets passed on to the ethical minister. In other words, there's much more tougher rules on the way the businesses that MPs have are run.
Yeah, well, they're supposed to have overseers, but it always looks to my eyes as though the statutory bodies that are, you know, like the...
Are mates.
Well, not quite. But they act in a way, like for instance, the MPs' pay. The MPs used to award themselves a pay rise, and then that became rather embarrassing, and so they farmed it out to a supposed independent body, which then, to no one's surprise, gave MPs more of a pay rise than MPs could ever have thought that they could get away with if they were still setting their own pay.
Exactly. But, I mean, for instance, as I was saying, you know, on the sort of flip side of society, if you want to rent a flat, if you want to get a job, or certainly I bring students over, you know, the kind of the paperwork involved is incredible. Why can't there be that kind of diligent look at MPs rather than make it... You know, I just get the feeling it's more like, yeah, okay, well, it'll be fine.
Well, we're still on the decent chap principle, aren't we? But there's precious few of them around. Thanks, Max. Coventry. Hello, John.
Oh, good evening, Nick. Isn't it endemic that if MPs are having a problem with the cost of living, isn't that something they're trying to prevent? Do you know what I mean? I mean, if they're sort of being affected where they have to have two jobs... Does that mean they're failing in their role?
Yeah, I don't think that have is the appropriate word in that sentence. I don't think they have to have two jobs. They just enjoy the extra income.
Well, during the war, going back a bit, MPs did it purely for the love of their community. I mean, it was literally expenses came from the fact that if you were a councillor, you could go and, you know, enjoy the benefits of being a councillor and only claim expenses because you had a love of your community and you had a sort of a calling to fight for the people that were around you. And
yes, I understand your point, but that would lead us to a position where only those who are independently wealthy can afford to be MPs.
Well, no, because people used to have, they were shop stewards, they worked in factories, and then there would be a councillor on the side. I mean, you even a councillor today, you cannot be a councillor and have it as your only form of income. You have to have another job. So it is historically a sort of calling rather than a career. So if you go blindly into being a politician and say, oh, God, it's not enough money, you're in the wrong job. And also, on top of that, I mean, a lot of them are not even smart enough to be in the City of London, so they end up being an MP because they're a bit, you know, a couple of slices short of a loaf, aren't they? You know what I mean? So,
I won't ask you to name names, but I appreciate that, John.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. Mm. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/UK.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Top up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours too. I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
This is LBC. It's 11 o'clock. The news headlines with Tim Daly.
Good evening from Global's newsroom. The Israeli military says it's killed a journalist who was working for Al Jazeera in a strike on Gaza City. It's accused Anas al-Sharif of heading a Hamas cell. Neither his death nor that claim have yet been verified. The Palestinian political analyst Ahmed Najjar has been talking to Nick Abbott on LBC in the last half hour.
He was reporting from the north of Gaza, when no one actually dared to report from there because Israel was targeting journalists from there. He was threatened personally, as he announced in his social media, by the Israeli army that they will kill him, and sadly they just managed to do that.
Earlier this evening, ambassadors at the United Nations were condemning what they've been calling Israel's dangerous plan to expand military operations in Gaza. An emergency meeting was called by the UN Security Council after Benjamin Netanyahu's security cabinet approved a plan to occupy Gaza City. A man is due in court tomorrow after being charged with the murder of a father and son in London. 31-year-old Hassan Sevik is also accused of grievous bodily harm connected to a third person. He was arrested after 4 people were found with stab wounds in Bermondsey on the 28th of July. President Zelensky's been thanking Western allies, including the UK, after they issued calls for Ukraine to be involved in peace talks being organised by the US. Donald Trump is due to meet Vladimir Putin on Friday, but the former NATO spokesman, Mark Leahy, has been telling LBC he's not holding out much hope.
He's not coming to Alaska to do a deal in any way other than one which would in effect be a Ukrainian withdrawal. So there's no signs at present that I can see anything good coming out of this.
In the last hour, Russian officials have announced the deaths of 2 people in the Tula region following a Ukrainian drone strike. They're also saying Moscow has been targeted. And the English actor Ray Brooks has died at the age of 86. He was best known for narrating the children's TV programme Mr. Ben during the 1970s. He also played Joe Mason in EastEnders. LBC weather mostly clear overnight with some mist and fog patches. Cloudier in the north though, with rain moving across Northern Ireland, Scotland, and parts of the far north of England will see a low of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
European allies are insisting that any peace talks with Russia must include Ukraine. A White House official says that Donald Trump is willing to hold a trilateral meeting, which would also include Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, but it remains a Trump-Putin summit, as requested by the Russian leader. Let's talk about this with Dr. Stephen Hall. Dr. Hall is Assistant Professor of Russian and Post-Soviet Politics at the University of Bath. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Nick.
Can a meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump about the Ukraine war have any value if Ukraine isn't represented?
Well, it can have value in terms of value for Vladimir Putin. It gives him legitimacy that he's sitting down with Donald Trump, the great so-called superpowers, at least in the Kremlin's thinking. Russia is still a great power, along with America and China, and they're solving the world crisis. So it gives him legitimacy. It highlights that Russia is no longer isolated. The Russians are already talking about Trump coming to Moscow. So, you know, it helps them. So someone does achieve something out of it, and that's Vladimir Putin.
It is extraordinary, though. I mean, we've got used to Donald Trump getting what he wants at all times. But Putin has insisted that the meeting doesn't include Ukraine's Zelensky, and Trump went along with that. Is it my imagination, or is Putin about the only world leader that Trump defers to?
Well, it does seem to be that way. I mean, Trump seems to have a personal love affair with a lot of autocrats. Vladimir Putin is probably his greatest bromance with, I mean, apart from possibly Kim Jong-un briefly, when he called him Little Rocket Man back in his first presidential term. So, yes, Vladimir Putin does seem to have the hoodoo over Donald Trump, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, I'm not sure Little Rocket Man is a term of endearment. Well, maybe it is.
Well, I don't know if it is a term of endearment, but he seems to be use it jokingly and talks about Kim Jong-un in glowing terms, at least briefly.
Now, Trump talks about the swapping of territories, doesn't he? That's what he is expecting to get out of this meeting, and a way to bring this war to a conclusion. The swapping of territories, that's what Trump said. Is he just making things up off the top of his head, or is there a realistic prospect of that happening?
Well, I don't know what goes on in Donald Trump's head, but I would say that it's certainly a vivid imagination. There seems to have been a misunderstanding from Steve Witkoff when he was in Moscow that the Russians would willingly leave Kherson and Zaporizhia Oblast. Now we're hearing that actually that was a misunderstanding from Witkoff. So we're back to Putin demanding pretty much what he's demanded from the beginning of the war. Ukrainian neutrality, denazification, possibly Ukrainian demilitarization, and facts on the ground, which is to say the Donbass and Kherson and Zaporizhia, and of course Ukraine has to accept the annexation of Crimea.
And Ukraine is accepting none of the above.
Ukraine can't accept the above without a referendum. It would need to change its constitution. So that is certainly going to be problematic for Ukraine, and it would also lead and be problematic for Europe, because it would mean the major change of international borders. It would also highlight to Vladimir Putin that might is right, and that he could perhaps do it again in the near future.
And assuming that this swapping of territories idea is not just Donald Trump extemporizing, that there is some sort of method to the madness, is it possible that this is actually a trap, that that Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump will come out from this meeting and say that, you know, we have a solution, and Zelensky will say, well, no, I can't agree with that, and then Zelensky will be painted as being the person to blame for the continuation of this war?
Well, I think that we can certainly assume that there will be no swapping territories, primarily because I don't think the Kremlin wants it. What you said after that, I think, could potentially be a real possibility. There are two options. The Russians are very good at
spinning negotiations out for when, however long they need. As I said already, the Kremlin is already talking about Donald Trump coming to Moscow or to Russia after Alaska. So you can imagine that these will be beginnings of negotiations, and then Moscow will announce, oh, we need to have more negotiations, and let's do Moscow this time. And it's possible, of course, that Donald Trump, who needs a victory, will decide to acquiesce to what Vladimir Putin has said. He's already agreed, possibly, to talking about the real causes of the war, which for Vladimir Putin is to get to make weaken NATO. And then Trump will turn around to Zelensky and say, well, I've done this deal, and now you have to accept it. And if you don't accept it, then we're not going to sell weapons to other NATO countries. We're not going to share intelligence with you, and you'll be on your own.
Yeah, what do you make of the reasoning for the war in the first place from Putin, that it was a NATO encroachment on his territory that forced his hand?
Well, I don't have any. I'm trying not to swear here, Nick, but I would say that Vladimir Putin is living in a dreamland in regards to NATO being the causes for this war. It is very much a nationalist, imperialist, colonialist. You can choose whatever type you want. War that was created in Vladimir Putin's mind. He believes that Ukraine is part of Russia, that Russia has a sphere of influence. We're going back to the 19th century of realist politics as well. And NATO is something that he's used to convince Western audiences that Russia does have a justification for this war. It's very much the traditional Russia playing the role of victim that the Kremlin has done so well over so many years.
And Donald Trump plays victim all the time. Everybody is against him and being very mean. Could it be that in his desperation to get this fabled Nobel Peace Prize, that Donald Trump will insist that whatever he comes out with from Putin in this meeting, Ukraine will say no, and Europe has already said that Russia taking territory by force is not acceptable. So could the rest of the West find itself in a conflict then with Russia and America if it doesn't acquiesce to their demands?
Well, I don't know if it will necessarily find itself in a conflict with America. As far as I'm aware, these various institutions within America, yes, Donald Trump does rule the roost, but they still do have a positive working relationship with Europe, with NATO. So I don't imagine there will be a conflict. I can imagine that Donald Trump will decide to withdraw back across the Atlantic Ocean and leave the Europeans to settle this by themselves. He's tried the negotiations. He may try to also build up a bilateral relationship with Russia, trying to work towards his Nobel Peace Prize. Who knows? But certainly Europe is going to find it very difficult if America effectively abandons Europe. It spent the last decade, in my opinion, since the war actually began in 2014, putting its head in the sand and hoping this would all go away. And that's certainly been the case since 2022. Yes, it supported Ukraine. It's done brilliantly to remain united. But there has been a need to start rebuilding its military and building its military infrastructure since the war began in 2022, which it hasn't done, and is therefore reliant on America to protect Europe.
And if America pulls all of its support for Ukraine in a huff, in relation to the position that you just put out, can Europe make up the difference?
It would be touch and go. Now, it depends on how much of a huff America has. Is America, as J.D. Vance said on Fox News, willing to get other NATO allies to pay for its military? Vance said yes. So that would still mean that Western European governments could buy weapons for Ukraine from America. But it all depends on which Donald Trump is in Alaska and what happens on the day. And that is particularly worrying.
Let's imagine the best outcome. The war is ended. Borders remain unchanged. Is it likely that Vladimir Putin would accept that what to his eyes would be a defeat? Or will he be more likely to rebuild his forces in order to go again?
Well, I mean, I can't imagine that Vladimir Putin would accept that. I mean, the best case scenario here is Ukraine returning to its 1991 borders. So, no, it would be. I can't imagine that Vladimir Putin would accept that. He would. The Russian military is already rebuilding itself. That's been quite clear for a long time. The economy is on a war footing. It would be very difficult for Putin to stop the war economy and move back to a civilian economy, primarily because that part of the economy has been shuttered. So it is certainly Russia is on a war footing and has been for quite a while. Russian state media has been talking about how, not just since 2022, but even before then, how Russia is fighting against the West. And after 2022, the battleground was Ukraine. So I can certainly envisage that this would be a stopgap. If Donald Trump was to acquiesce in Vladimir Putin's demands, Ukrainian neutrality, demilitarization, the acceptance of five regions of Ukraine becoming part of Russia, and probably the lifting of sanctions, Putin is going to get the green light to the idea that might means right. And therefore, I can imagine, we'll do the same again in the future, or whoever follows Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin.
I mean, you said that the economy is on a war footing. Some people might be surprised that they have anything of an economy left. All of these sanctions, are they actually having an effect?
Sanctions take time, and sanctions are also unwieldy. Countries can find ways around them. I mean, look at Iran. It's been under sanctions since the 1990s, as far as I remember. Belarus has pretty much been under sanctions since 1994, when its president, Alexander Lukashenko, started to infringe on democracy. So countries can survive sanctions for a long time, and Russia has a large economy. Sanctions are taking an effect, but as I say, they need to be tightened, and the workarounds need to be found. But having said that, Russia has been moving its economy towards a war footing. Factories are now working three shifts a day, building up military equipment, from drones to tanks and various other things. The number of Russians being pushed into fighting, being pushed into being soldiers, is also still going up. So, as I say, Russia's economy is militarizing.
But where are they getting the money from?
Well, as I say, Putin doesn't necessarily need to worry too much about the consumer economy, the private sector, as it were. He can invest what he has in terms of the military. They're also finding ways around the sanctions in terms of getting support from China, Kazakhstan, Turkey, Armenia, India, and in terms of the fact that they are willing to sell oil at whatever level, whatever price they can get. So all of this is still playing a role in terms of the economy. And on top of that, the average Russian is actually doing relatively well. They are getting paid on time. They're working because the factories they work at are doing lots more. What we are seeing is, though, that the consumer economy is starting to suffer in places that aren't building weapons, aren't moving towards a military economy. They're on to four-day working days. The inflation has gone up as well in terms of bread, food prices. So it is touch and go at the moment. And as I say, sanctions need to be kept and they also need to be tightened. But we'll see whether that actually happens with Donald Trump in Alaska on the 15th of August. He's already talked about possibly loosening sanctions, which is rather worrying, along with many other things.
And without any major breakthrough, let's assume there isn't, it looks like the war is at something of a standstill, doesn't it? Neither side are winning or look likely to do so.
Well, that's indeed certainly the case. Certainly, Ukraine and Zelensky has said as much. We can't take back our territories militarily. The Russian army, apparently Russian generals have told Putin that the Ukrainian army is going to collapse in 3 months. They probably have information that I don't have, but that seems unlikely. The Russian army is progressing very, very slowly. Someone said that it would take 76 years for them to actually get as far as Kiev if they were to continue at the current pace. So it is certainly moving towards a stalemate, but by being
in this war by stopping the Russian army from taking Kiev, Ukraine is victorious. By surviving, Ukraine is victorious, and therefore Western countries should continue to support Ukraine in terms of helping its economy, in terms of supporting its military, and also giving it a prospectus in terms of future NATO and EU membership.
Very good to talk to you, Doctor. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Hall, Assistant Professor of Russian and Post-Soviet Politics at the University of Bath. So what do you make of this Trump-Putin summit? Is there any point in having it if Volodymyr Zelensky isn't there to represent the interests of Ukraine? And do you think that, as I said, this is a trap? Trump and Putin setting a trap for Zelensky. Trump and Putin will announce a peace plan that Zelensky can't possibly agree to. And then Zelensky will be, perhaps blamed for the continuation of the war, and B, might see the US join Russia, or at least with the US withdraw their support for Ukraine. And in that circumstance, do you think that we should fill the gap? And what do you think of our actions in all this? Are we helping enough or too much? 0345 6060 973. LBC.
This is LBC.
Who's a good human? Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny.
Oh.
Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Nuromol Dual Action contains the power of ibuprofen
and the strength of paracetamol
combined together to provide faster, longer-lasting, more effective relief than regular painkillers alone. Hit pain hard
with Nuromol Dual Action Pain Relief.
Contains ibuprofen and paracetamol for pain not relieved by regular painkillers. Ibuprofen or paracetamol individually.
Always read the label.
Get the news your way and combine breaking news with expert opinion to see the full picture.
With award-winning journalism on air and in your hand, the LBC app puts you in control.
The biggest stories of the day delivered how you want it
and when you want it.
Download the LBC app now.
News your way.
Now in your hands.
With Little Plus Bakery Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free Little Bakery coupon on every shop. Download Little Plus and get a little bit more at the Retail Industry Awards Supermarket of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability, ends 20th of August. Full T's and C's apply. See little.co.uk/spin.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Well, we are talking about the prospect of peace. Trump and Putin are meeting for what is described as peace talks, and let's assume that that is what is happening. A White House official said that Trump was willing to hold a trilateral meeting, which would include the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, but that's not going to happen because Vladimir Putin doesn't want it to. Seems extraordinary, really, that Donald Trump, who is a person who seems to have the ability to get what he wants at all times, defers to no one as much as he does the Russian president. Zelensky has said that any agreements without a representative of Ukraine at the table will amount to what he called dead decisions. So is this all a giant waste of time, or is there actually something else going on here? 0345 6060 973. And of course, the one thing that Trump has said, and we don't really know where he got this from, whether he's just, you know, opens his mouth and it just, whatever is flitting across his brow just spews out, he said that there will be some swapping of territories in order for Moscow and Kyiv to reach an agreement. Well, that might be okay for Vladimir Putin, apart from the swapping part, but it's absolutely not fine for Ukraine. What do you make of all this? 0345 6060 973. East Yorkshire. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, I want to come at this from two points, basically. Firstly, the fact that Zelensky wasn't invited to start with is a clear signal to the world that it's irrelevant. So whether they in fact have him there now or not is irrelevant. because Russia and America have jointly declared Zelensky's of no relevance in this. We'll deal with it, which is horrendous in its own way. But it won't matter whether he's there or not. The worst thing that could happen if he turns up is that Putin and Trump do a double job on what happened in the Oval Office.
Hmm. Criticise him for his dress sense.
Etc. Yeah, but the other thing I want to point out with this, think about all the people that worked with Trump in his first presidency. Numerous people came out and said it was absolutely crucial with Donald Trump that you were the last person to talk to him on any subject.
Yes.
Look what's happened with him. He has a call with Putin. He's all in favour of Putin and Russia. 2 or 3 days later, other people get to him, and then he comes out and criticises Russia. Then he has another word with Putin. He's all back in Russia's direction again. We've got someone in control of the Western world who has no character, morals, conscience, or any concept of what happens with international politics. There's no theme, there's no policy, there's no strategy in terms of the whole thing. He simply listens to the last person he's talked to.
Yes, which is worrying in that the only person that he will talk to on this is Vladimir Putin. And we know his reaction when he's presented with Vladimir Zelensky. It was nothing but aggression. It was really quite remarkable, that meeting. It has to be one of the worst meetings of two leaders of a country that has been televised in history.
Yeah, I mean, it's falling, but they did much the same to the South African guy as well. I mean, it's a tactic that they use, but this is how you do property deals, Nick. You pressurise people, and who did he send to Moscow? Witkoff. And he's come back apparently with the wrong idea. He hasn't understood what was explained to him in Moscow, and this is Trump's chief delegate who's been tasked with dealing with it. You've got two property guys trying to deal with Putin. If I was Russian and Putin dropped dead tomorrow and I had to take over, I'd just look at them as a pair of idiots and say, right, we stick to our guns, we tell them what we need, they'll go away, they'll mooch about it for a bit, they'll come back, we tell them again, we'll win.
It does seem that there's...
And you would look at what's happening in America at the minute, unfortunately.
Mm. It does seem that there's only going to be one winner out of this summit, and it will be Vladimir Putin, because Putin, whatever his lack of qualities in other areas, he certainly is a very intelligent man, and he speaks in complete sentences and uses words of many syllables, and Donald Trump is none of the above. So I think he'll just run rings around him, as he has done up to this point.
And Putin will just look at Trump and go, oh, he's crying about all these people dying. Putin isn't crying about the people dying. I'm not saying he likes it. He doesn't care.
I'm not sure either of them care. I'm not sure that Donald Trump is actually concerned about people dying at all. He just seems to have this really bizarre urge to get his hands on a Nobel Peace Prize, which I think is perhaps the only reason why he's going to Alaska in the first place. And that's why, other than they gave one to Barack Obama, and he wants at least as much as Barack Obama ever got. The other reason I can think, well, the money, it comes with $1 million, and the coin that they give you is in his favourite colour, gold. Other than that, I can't fathom it.
No, there is that, but I did, on that note, I watched an American documentary today, and they showed you Obama's inauguration, and the place was, there was no standing room, people were on each other's shoulders, and I think that got to Trump as well.
Well, I haven't heard him go on about it lately, but it was all he could talk about for months afterwards, the size of his crowd. It was the biggest crowd that anybody has ever seen in the history of recorded time.
Just look at the documentary evidence.
Yes. All right, good to talk to you, Mike. Thanks for that. Keith in Belfast says, one guaranteed outcome of this summit is that Trump will claim he's done a great deal while going easy on Putin. He will leave the summit with his arm outstretched to the Nobel Committee, begging for the Peace Prize he delusionally thinks he deserves. Trump shouldn't legitimise these talks by letting them take place without Zelensky. Darby, hello, Brent.
Hello, my friend. There are times when you sort of hear things and you see parallels and you think, am I imagining this? But this has happened before. Of course, because history repeats itself. 1935, Abyssinia. appeals to the international community. Italian aggression is rewarded when Britain and France, behind Abyssinia's back, sell them out. And there is historical precedent for, which led to, of course, World War II, was the appeasement agenda of aggression gets rewarded. The Japanese got what they wanted out of Manchuria when they invaded, and the international community in the world was basically giving in to fascist or militaristic dictatorships. We have been here before. We are meant to learn the lessons of the past. And literally, everything is playing out from the 30s playbook. We are literally seeing it play out almost again. So I don't trust either Putin, or I do not trust America. And I think we have to now assume that the United States of America is no longer the ally that we went and did World War II as an ally to us, because all they're doing is acting in the self-interest of a demagogue who is only after his own agenda, and a former KGB spy who ran Berlin like his own little fiefdom. So this is who we're up against. And Keir Starmer is not exactly going to do what? The hardliner and stand up to them. They will take the least path of resistance. And we're in a very kind of dangerous place as the world at the moment if we tolerate or let this, because quite simply, in the late 30s, as was coined the phrase, appeasement makes the aggressor stronger. And we know exactly how that ends up. So I think we're in a very strange position if we tolerate this, the international community tolerates this, and a deal is done without the permission of the Ukrainian people. It would literally be a recreation of what's happened before.
But unlike in the instances you just described, Europe is against this summit without Zelensky. There's a joint statement issued by the leaders of this country and France, Italy, interestingly, Germany, Poland, Finland, and the European Commission. They've all issued a statement suggesting that peace talks without Ukraine will not be valid.
True, but the precedent is also when the British and the American people, British and the French people found out about this, French press found out about the secret deal, the populations of those countries were still in uproar, but the damage was done. And the damage was the fact that our governments weren't strong enough to stand up to, and because people were so afraid of causing another great war, which ironically, that so afraid of causing another war was one of the reasons why the war happened in the first place, because we didn't stand up to aggressive people. It is not exactly the same, but it has got striking parallels. But the parallel, of course, is quite simply this. We have nations that cannot be trusted, that are doing deals, selling off land of other countries. This is empiric. This is almost 19th century empires, isn't it? This is not what we expect in the 21st century. But then, as we know, history has a way of repeating itself, and the patterns are there, and we're meant to learn from these mistakes. And allowing Russia to sell it, to take parts of Ukraine, would be a very, very dangerous precedent, because what does China say? We can get Taiwan now. What about other parts? You are opening up a whole Pandora's box where you completely change the rules of international sort of diplomacy, which were set in motion from 1949 onwards. And I think Israel and Palestine situation is also showing that the cracks are showing, aren't they, in the international community. Never again, we said on certain things. But that never again on certain things seems to be crossing lines. And we're even talking about building a new generation of nuclear weapons. It's almost as if the 80 years of Nagasaki the other day never happened.
Well, it's a truism that the only thing that anybody ever learns from history is that nobody ever learns anything from history. Good to talk to you, Brent. Thanks for that. What do you make of what's been said so far, and what do you make of our position in all this? Do you think that we are actually doing enough? The sums are quite eye-watering. As far as I'm aware, we've given £13 billion in military aid, £5 billion in non-military aid, and the total of assistance and help of whatever type that we've given to Ukraine is £21 billion, which is about 11% of the NHS budget. 0345 6060 973. So more of your thoughts on that to come. But as you must be aware, quite hot out today, and it's going to get even hotter. The UK bracing for its fourth heat wave of the summer. Temperatures peaking. Well, could be a record. And I'll be joined by a meteorological consultant. You try it. After this news break with Tim Davey.
The Israeli military says it's killed a journalist who was working for Al Jazeera during a strike in Gaza City. It's accused Anas al-Sharif of heading a Hamas cell. Neither of those claims have yet been verified. A man's due in court tomorrow after being charged with the murder of a father and son at Bermondsey in London. 31-year-old Hassan Sevik is also accused of grievous bodily harm connected to a third person. And the English actor Ray Brooks has died at the age of 86. He was best known for narrating the children's TV programme Mr. Ben during the 1970s. LBC weather mostly clear overnight with some mist and fog patches developing, cloudier in the north with rain moving across Northern Ireland and Scotland, and a low of 13 degrees.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
A wildfire northwest of Los Angeles is forcing thousands of people to evacuate. What is now being called the Canyon Fire was fueled by a heat wave in which temperatures reached 100 degrees. The most devastating wildfire to sweep across France in nearly eight decades has finally been contained after a days-long inferno that left behind a trail of scorched earth and burnt-out homes. In Greece, wildfires consumed nearly 16,000 acres of land. In Spain, firefighters continued to battle a wildfire in Avila province, over 62 miles west of Madrid, and scientists warn that climate change is exacerbating the frequency and intensity of heat and dryness, making us all more vulnerable to wildfires. But the well-known expert Richard Tice grinningly informs us that climate change isn't real, so that's okay then. Let's talk about this with Jim Dale. Jim is the founder and senior meteorological consultant at British Weather Services. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Nick. Good evening.
It's like a stop clock, really, isn't it? It's like every week something like this.
Yeah, you can't sort of breathe and before the next event occurs. And as we're speaking, you may have seen coming home now, you may have seen pictures of fires. I think it was in Devon and all, but certainly in and around Edinburgh, the arts match today, you can see it quite clearly on the hills around the gorse and the heath burning away. Thankfully, it is the, and I say that advisedly, it is the heath and not the buildings that are burning at this moment in time. But you've mentioned all of these places around the world that are being affected by wildfires, and obviously it's the underlying conditions caused by dry weather for prolonged periods, exceptional temperatures in certain cases. And you don't have to go too far. As I say, I mean, Greece, it's happened in Portugal, it's happened in Spain, it's happened in France. How near do you want to get? And these things are very real.
Now, we've had very little rain this year. Is that the same? Is that the case with the rest of Europe?
Yeah, more or less. It's come in spurts. The Alps have done, the Alpine region has done slightly better, and it will do. I'll just give you this for now. Just watch the space going forward for the Alps with the hot weather coming, and then the usual place, the mountainous areas, get the big deluges and thunderstorms. So, but for the most part, yeah, look, southern Spain, it's the new Sahara Desert. If you ever fly over Spain, and people do, and you look down and you look at it, it reminds me of the moon to a certain degree. And you're thinking, Jesus, you know, this is supposed to be a fertile land. It's got a problem, and especially in the south, with the advance of the Sahara Desert, etc. I'll include Morocco in that. Obviously, Morocco's obviously got a lot of sand anywhere. I went there some time ago and into the desert from there. It's just, how can I put this? It's just moving northwards. Along with, should we give you a bit of positive news? Ooh. New forms of butterflies are occurring, new species of butterflies are occurring in the UK.
I've seen a lot of butterflies this year. It's been remarkable how many are fluttering around this year.
Yeah, and I'm walking in the woods this afternoon near me in High Wycombe, and I'm seeing these brown ones, and I'm seeing these white ones, which are not just the plain old cabbage stuff. I'm talking about things I've never seen before, and I'm thinking, am I imagining this? I'm not an entomologist. But I'm sure there are better people than me know that the new species and the, and it, look, the thing about that, isn't that a clear sign of what is going on? Because if we can't see it with our own eyes, then the wildlife and the fauna and the flora are showing it for us.
Yes, and there's more worrying types of insects than butterflies that are coming our way as well. I mean, they're talking about mosquitoes and these killer wasps and all sorts of bad things that we're not used to here, but we might have to get used to.
Very much so, and the diseases that they bring, the dengue fever and such, malaria for the other one. Look, you know, the whole sphere is moving from, you know, the tropical world, subtropical world, Mediterranean world, into the temperate world, which is our world that we live in. Anybody who's living in the, who's listening in the UK or these sort of temperate areas, it's changing. The worrying thing here, Nick, is it's changing in front of our eyes. It's not taking 1,000 years or 10,000 years, which is the usual process as far as climate change is concerned. It takes sometimes millions of years. But, in you know, these things normally you don't see in your lifetime. We're seeing it, and we're seeing it in stark realization. And I think it's actually it's surprising, if not shocking, climatologists, scientists that are involved in this, oceanographers and others, how fast it's actually moving.
Yes, they were predicting that, that what we're seeing now would be in our distant future, and it has taken them somewhat by surprise that their predictions have come true much quicker than they thought they would.
Yeah, it's a bit like looking at the weather maps on a normal day and thinking, right, okay, what's next Friday going to look like? And before you know it, it's what you thought was arriving on Friday is arriving on Thursday. If you get my point, things tend to happen that little bit quicker than the models, the AI models anticipate. We can talk about AI and weather forecasting and all of that. You still need people behind that to actually look at these things and decide whether or not they're useful. I mean, I use the AI side of things and what have you, and sometimes, you know, you're looking at one AI product and then another and then another, and they're all arguing with each other. Okay, let's go back to basics then and have a little finger in the air, you know, and all the rest of it. So,
but this desertification, because they've got a word for it, haven't they? It's going to affect the price of our food and the availability of our food too. Jeremy Clarkson was talking about this the other day. He used to be a climate change skeptic. I don't know whether he was just doing it for the lols or whether he actually believed it. But now he's not, because now he's actually invested in the business of farming. And last year was a complete washout. His crops were drowned, as was the case with the farmers everywhere in this country. And in this year, it's completely the opposite, but it's had the same effect. They can't grow anything.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? It's got to happen, you know, to you, to make you realise. This is, I'm now speaking about deniers, if you like, climate deniers. It's got to happen to you before you take notice. And unless you've got a financial reason for denying climate change, man-made climate change, then you'll continue to do that even if that happens. But if you are in the business of a farmer and you can see what's happening, and I talk to a lot of farmers in my daily job, they know it. They absolutely know it. And you probably know from the news today about a certain political party that you've just mentioned at the very beginning with Richard Tice. The denying side of it, let's just say something's starting to happen, something's starting to stir. This is, I'm referring to the younger generation of so-called reform supporters. That'd probably be the under 70s. okay, that was a little joke, wasn't I?
Yes.
They are basically rejecting what I've been, and not just me, but other people as well.
Yeah.
But me on air, on TV, on GB News, on Talk TV, wherever I've gone to fence with them, the fact that denial of climate change is wrong and not just wrong, but dangerous.
Yeah, and it doesn't. We've mentioned this before. It doesn't really matter whether you believe in climate change or not. It's going to get you, because farmers, as we've described, they believe and know, because they live with it every day. They understand that the climate is changing, but crucially, insurers believe that the climate is changing, because they have to keep paying out for the consequences of it.
Yeah,
which means that they will quite soon be refusing en masse to insure people's homes because they don't think they're viable. And then you won't be able to get a mortgage, and you won't be able to buy them, and then what?
and the knock-on effects. And it's a little bit strange you should mention insurers. On a personal basis, I'm off to the City of London. Now, this is not until November, but I'm speaking in a fairly grand place, whatever it is. It's not the Mansion House, but it's somewhere close. And it is to a bunch of insurers. And let's make this clear. They are very, very onside. Why? Because they crunch the numbers. They see it in real time. And what's at stake for them is their livelihood.
Yeah.
They can see it. A bit like farmers, if you like. Mm-hmm. But they're putting their money up, basically saying, this won't happen to you. You know, you're going to be okay because you're going to insure with us, and therefore you're going to give us your money, and it's not going to happen to you, is it? Because that's their bet, if you like. But, and it is a big but, there is going to come a time when they're going to say, well, actually, it is going to happen to you, so we're not going to insure you.
Well, it's happening already. I mean, those people in Los Angeles who lost their houses in that fire, many of them had their insurance pulled the previous spring by insurers because they thought, well, you know, it's just too dangerous. We're going to lose too much money.
Yeah, so they lost everything. And more and more of that. Whether we're talking about wildfires or whether we're talking about more appropriately floods that are going on, particularly in Japan at this moment in time, in certain areas, and China the same, because if you don't get the extreme heat or the wildfires, you get the other one.
Yes.
And that's the, you know, I know there's a middle ground, and we've just been through it in the UK in terms of saying, okay, this is reasonable, it's nice weather, etc. You get that as well. But either extremes, those are the two extremes that you get. You get the wildfires and the heat and all. And at the moment, we're heading towards, very much so, the heat wave and the wildfires, and we'll see what comes next.
Abnormal is the new normal. Well, that's all climate change. Let's talk about the weather, because, you know, regardless of everything that we've just said, it's been pretty glorious this year. It's beaten 1976, hasn't it? This is the best summer we've ever had, right?
Yeah, and you can add spring to that, because you know what spring was like, and farmers definitely will know what spring was like. So look, this is just extended, and it does feel like you're in the Mediterranean. It feels like you're in southern Spain or something all of
on
a sudden.
Holiday. Yeah, well, you can leave the house without a jacket, knowing that you won't need one, even if you come back at night.
No wonder people are staying at home for that, and it's not just economics. It is the weather that they know they can get the better weather here, so why not? You know, fully focused. So, what's coming?
Yes.
All right. So, the heat wave starts today, and it moves through Tuesday and Wednesday, and in the east on Thursday. So, it's a four-day event. It has to be 3 days to be called a heat wave officially. Right. So, where we are in terms of temperature profiles, the high so far this year, 35.8 Faversham in Kent. That's 96.4 in old money.
Wow.
Will we beat that? Will we beat that? I think there is a chance. There's a chance.
Really?
It's an outside chance. I think we're probably going to hit the 34 somewhere, probably get 34 and a half, maybe 35 at a push. All-time August high is 38.5 back in August 2003. That's 100 Fahrenheit. I don't think we're going to get there. Funny enough, that again was Faversham in Kent. So something about Faversham. Those people who are in Faversham, you'll know the reasons why. But I'm not just looking at the UK here, because that will come to an end as we go through the week. It'll revert more or less what we've had during the course of the weekend and just before it. So hopefully not too long with that. But look south, France, Spain, Portugal, those places in particular, but others as well, even places like, you know, to the east of us, Netherlands and Belgium, they could be looking at all-time high records. And don't be surprised, because those records have been falling globally in places that don't necessarily, you know, ring the bell as far as our media is concerned, through the course of the summer. And it continues on. So France is high, 45.9, 115.
Ooh,
Spain's high, 47.6.
Really?
115. Yeah. Spain is 118 Fahrenheit, and Portugal 47.317.
Ooh,
all of them.
That's way too
records,
hot.
Yeah, all of those records in the 21st century. In other words, 2003 to 2021.
Have we ever had as little rain as this year before, in your memory?
Great question. In my memory, which goes back a long way, I do remember 76, and that was about 16, 17 days worth. And you know what happened then? We had torrential floods in September. I think the answer is no. I cannot remember stringing together. Now, this is different in different parts of the country. The further north and west you go, if you're listening in Western Scotland, you know it's not the driest year, summer you've ever had.
Well, listeners in Glasgow will always get their own weather.
Yeah, Glasgow northwards, but I love Scotland. I love the geography and the topography. It's fantastic. So, you know, even with the weather, look, let's just take that one. But further south, let's just say from the M62 southwards, particularly a little bit of the northeast as well, I think you're absolutely right. This is, as I've already said, this is like living in the Mediterranean. Mm. And it's going to feel like that. Let's make this absolutely clear, because what comes in these next few days isn't just this heat that's in the shade temperature. This is what we're quoting here. These are shade temperatures. It's also the heat index intermixed with the humidity. That's how you get to it. That is actually a killer.
Yeah.
That is why these warnings go out, the health warnings that go out. These temperatures are a killer, particularly to the elderly, particularly to the infirm, and those unable to cope with this type of weather. And if you're running a marathon, you're an idiot.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Well, there's certain things you don't do in these types of weather.
Right.
We can probably go into a few details that shouldn't be on this broadcast, but you see where I'm going with it. It's going to be a tough time for 3 or 4 days, and people have to do the right thing, whether we're talking about wildfire caused mainly by humans, and I don't just mean arson, I mean cigarettes
idiots.
Being thrown away, all of that sort
morons.
Of stuff.
Yeah.
All the ice. Yeah, you know what I'm trying to say. So we have to look after it, going for ourselves and those around us going forward, and that's where we are at this moment in time, Nick.
Very good to talk to you, Jim. That's Jim Dale, founder and senior meteorological consultant at British Weather Services. Now, I'm going to take a short break and then back to what we were talking about before. This meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, without Ukraine, is it actually worth having? And what do you make of our role in all this? Do you think that we've been helping enough, or have we been perhaps helping too much? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
LBC, coming up next week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
As police fear a weekend of demos, the issue over the ethnicity of suspects becomes hotter than ever.
We do think that the guidance needs to change.
A call on the police from a Home Secretary feeling the heat. But are the police willing to listen? West Midlands Chief Constable Craig Guildford.
We produce loads of data, and of course we want to give as much information as possible, but we have to operate within the bounds of the rules of the law.
And as US Vice President J.D. Vance heads off to the Cotswolds, LBC's Henry Riley finds out what welcome's in store for him down on the farm.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Pump 6 in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Ever want a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6.
T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
I'm an accountant, so even when I stop working, my brain doesn't. You know, I'll be halfway through dinner thinking about VAT returns. Then I started using Sage Copilot's VAT Assistant. It flags errors before I hit submit, so that's one less thing to worry about.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of HMRC expertise, supporting accountants like Josh from Yeomans Harrison and Associates Limited. That's more than artificial intelligence, that's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. T's and C's apply.
Save this summer with Lidl Plus. Get 2 for £7 on burgers, jumbo sausages and more. And get 2 for £3.50 on our plant burgers, veggie sausages and more veggie classics. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this summer today.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
We are talking about what is being billed as a peace summit between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. It's going to happen in Alaska at the end of next week, or, well, this week, Friday. And I'm wondering what you make of all this, particularly in that there won't be a representative there from Ukraine at Vladimir Putin's insistence. Walthamstow. Hello, Julia.
Hello, Nick. How are you? I've been waiting 30 minutes to speak to you.
Oh, sorry about that, Julia. I'm very well.
Well, I mean, I'm very honoured to speak to you because I think you've got the best sense of humour on this channel.
I've got the best sense of humour of anybody that is broadcasting at this minute.
Seriously, you do
on LBC.
I do laugh a lot when I'm listening to you.
I appreciate that.
And I like the chap in the morning. He's very good as well.
He is very good.
He's excellent, actually. But you have the sense of humour as well.
Okay. Enough of the flattery.
Which is really important, I think. Because you really make me laugh, anyway.
Well, I appreciate
that. I mean, you just have that...
Okay, less about me, please.
Less about you. Okay, so... Portugal, I'm going to Portugal in September, so I hope it's not as hot then, as the chap was saying. Nostradamus, you know, he predicted this, that the world would be destroyed by fire and flooding and all of that. So that's all been predicted. If you believe in all that, Codswallop,
no.
Which I do.
But on the subject,
Putin,
yes, Putin and Trump, yes, go ahead.
So I'm getting to Putin now and Trump. They're both narcissists, so they're sitting together, you know, in the drawing room, deciding which part of the world they're going to take over. That's what they're doing. They don't care about Ukraine. All they're interested in is what's underneath Ukraine, and they both want it. So now they're negotiating as to who's going to have what, a bit like Sykes-Picot back in the day. Over the Middle East. And so that's what's going on. And China is the big knob at the moment. And Russia is, you know, a little doggy who's licking, you know, their feet. And various other, you know, countries doing likewise. And Trump knows this. He's not an idiot. He is a good negotiator, despite what people say about him. You know, that's the Scottish side of him, of course. And they like a good deal, and he doesn't want to be... And, you know, you can just see what's going on here. I mean, you know, he's saying he's breaking ties with Britain because he knows that Britain is broken. So, therefore, you know, he can't be bothered with that.
Britain is... all right, okay. I think you're all over the shop there, Julie. I'm not sure that Britain is broken or that it has anything to do with what we're talking about, but I appreciate the many different and various thoughts that you just offered us. Appreciate that. Harrow, Herbie.
Good evening there, Nick.
Yes, Herbie.
Right, listen, the aggressor is Russia. Trump knows what he's doing already. Trump would never accept anybody taking over any parts of America if they invaded America. You know that, and I know that. And unfortunately, he's already got some raw materials from Ukraine being given to him or signed over to him for support anyway. You know, both of them, both Trump and Putin, are just a waste of space. You cannot agree anything unless all parties are involved. How can you... They can negotiate peace without all parties being involved. Nick, it's not possible.
It is impossible. So it makes you wonder what the actual purpose of it is. If it's not as stated, then what's going on?
Well, you tell me. Nobody seems to know. Why is Trump and Putin meeting together? As I said, Trump's already got his deal. Putin's going to have his deal. He's the aggressor. He's already invaded a sovereign state. So how can you say it's Ukraine's problem and fault? It's not. It's Putin's fault. And Trump is fueling the fire with it.
Yeah, I wonder if it is actually a trap that... I mean, I've just mentioned this before, but it seems... To my mind, the most likely outcome is that Putin and Trump will agree something or other that is unacceptable to Vladimir Putin, to Vladimir Zelensky, and Zelensky will say no, then he will be painted as the aggressor, the one that doesn't want peace, and then America will use that as an excuse to then, if not directly join Russia, then certainly withdraw all support for Ukraine. Probably while insisting on keeping their minerals that they
Exactly. So he's got his deal. Nick, he's got his deal. He's going to ruin Ukraine's possibilities of coming out of this, because you cannot negotiate with all the parties if they're not involved. It's not possible. You know, Ukraine's got to say yes or no to the deals that are going through. And if he's not there to deal with it and agree...
How can that happen? Yeah. Very good to talk to you, Herbie. Thanks for that. Let's see if I can squeeze one more in before the news. Ashford. Hello, Liam.
Good evening, Nick. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Good. Nick, I don't think that Putin should get one square inch of land from in Ukraine, because I think the guy's a criminal, and I don't think the orange idiot has any right to negotiate any land away. The land has been taken by force. I think he should be in The Hague, tried for mass murder and stealing land, and the orange idiot has no right whatsoever to negotiate on behalf of Ukraine.
Yeah, it does seem odd that Trump considers himself a fit and proper person to actually negotiate on, I suppose, on Ukraine's behalf, which just seems extraordinary, really.
He sees himself as king of the world rather than president of a country.
That's exactly how it looks, yeah. All right, good to talk to you, Liam. Thanks for that. Alan in Reigate says, Trump is not going to do a deal as he is already in Putin's pocket, and Putin is buying time as his economy is approaching collapse. It's taken a long time to collapse, isn't it? Rebecca says, Trump is known to go with the last opinion that he hears, so after the summit on Friday, he'll be back to his original Putin good, Zelensky bad stance. Ukraine has no chance. It's all about the peace prize. Right, well, thanks for your thoughts on that. Coming up after the news, the Education Secretary has pledged to tackle the generational challenge of British, white, working-class young people falling behind their peers. This is particularly at school and then university. Bridget Phillipson has called it her priority for the year ahead. Bridget Phillipson is the Education Secretary. So we'll be talking about that and taking your thoughts about why is it that white working class kids fall behind their peers at school? 0345 6060 973, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. The broadcaster Al Jazeera is accusing the Israeli military of murdering one of its journalists and four other colleagues in Gaza. Israel says he was killed in Gaza City and been heading a Hamas cell. The Qatari-based broadcaster is tonight quoting a human rights analyst as saying there was zero evidence to support that claim. On Sunday afternoon, Benjamin Netanyahu attacked what he called a global campaign of lies against Israel. He's also reiterated his plan to expand military operations in Gaza.
Our goal is not to occupy Gaza. Our goal is to free Gaza, free it from Hamas terrorists. The war can end tomorrow if Hamas lays down its arms and releases all the remaining hostages.
It's being reported the drink drive limit could be reduced as part of a new government attempt to reduce the number of road deaths. It's also believed older drivers may face mandatory eye tests, tougher penalties for driving without insurance, and failing to wear a seatbelt are due to be considered as well. Russian officials have announced the deaths of two people in the Tula region following a Ukrainian drone strike. They're also saying Moscow's been targeted as the countdown towards Friday's meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin continues. Sir Keir Starmer says it's vital Ukraine's leader is invited. The foreign policy analyst Jimmy Rushton has been telling LBC he agrees.
You obviously can't stop a war if you don't have one of the participants in that war
at the peace summit. And I think this is a case of the Americans overestimating their ability to force the Ukrainians to stop fighting, because what Ukraine is not going to do is agree to the leaked terms of this proposed ceasefire, which disadvantages Ukraine significantly.
A man's been charged with murdering a father and son following a stabbing at a business in London. Two other men were treated for stab wounds after being found in Bermondsey at the end of last month. 31-year-old Hassan Sevik will go before magistrates later on today. And a leading property firm is claiming rental charges for newly let homes have fallen for the first time in around 5 years. Hampton says they dropped by 0.2% this July compared with July 2024, but it also says rents are still rising in some places, with the largest increases being in the Midlands and the southwest of England. LBC weather mostly clear overnight with some mist and fog patches developing, cloudy in the north with rain moving across Northern Ireland, Scotland and parts of Northern England, and we'll see a low of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has pledged to tackle what she called the thorny generational challenge of British white working class young people falling behind their peers. She called it her priority for the year ahead and describes it as a national disgrace that so many young people are written off. Let's talk about this with Natalie Pereira. Natalie is the Chief Executive Officer of the Education Policy Institute. Good evening, Natalie.
Good evening, Nick.
This is a curious one, isn't it? If other ethnicities at the same schools, in the same areas, achieve more than white working class pupils, then what's behind that?
So if we take a bit of a step back, what we can see from the latest data that my organisation has analysed is that the Secretary of State is right to flag concerns about white British pupils. We know that since 2019, pupils from all other ethnicities have, on average, made better progress than white British pupils. But they're not the only group that we should be concerned about.
Sorry to interrupt, but you said white British pupils. Did you mean specifically white working class British pupils?
So with the data that I've got particularly, it looks at white British rather than white British and disadvantaged or working class or poorer families.
Right. So white pupils in general, regardless of the economic circumstances of their parents, are falling behind all other ethnicities.
Yeah, so our data has shown that since 2019, other ethnicities have made more progress than their white British counterparts. But there are still other ethnic groups that are still performing less well than white British pupils. And those include Black Caribbean pupils, travellers of Irish heritage and Gypsy Roma travellers. We also know that there's a wide gap between children with special educational needs and disabilities and their peers. Mm. So it's not only disadvantaged white British pupils that have been left behind. There are a number of other vulnerable groups, many of which have a number of vulnerabilities, but who we should also be concerned about.
Now, I don't know the stats. You know this better than I do. But if other ethnicities have made better progress than white British pupils since 2019, does that mean that they were starting from a level base, or that white British pupils were achieving more and the other ones are catching up?
Yeah, so it means that those who were already ahead of white British pupils, for example, Chinese and Indian pupils, have moved even further ahead. And those who were behind have either overtaken white British pupils, or they're starting to catch up at a faster rate. So that's what we mean.
Why would that be, though? I mean, why specifically white pupils in general, regardless of their economic circumstance?
So this is when we do come we do start to look at the impact of poverty. So we know that amongst the white British pupil cohort, there is a large gap between affluent white British pupils and more disadvantaged white British pupils. And poverty, and particularly persistent poverty, so being poor for the vast majority of your life, is a key driver of low education attainment. Not only can poverty affect the home learning environment and the likelihood of coming to school hungry, it can also affect the quality of education too. So, for example, we found that schools with larger numbers of poor pupils often struggle to recruit and retain high-quality teachers.
Yes, and the reason for that would be the behaviour of the pupils in these poorer schools, I would imagine.
It's certainly more challenging for a teacher to work in disadvantaged schools where there may be more problems with behaviour, wider social issues that are often correlated with poverty. And so what we've been calling for from the government is more funding for these schools so that they can pay those teachers more and put in place programmes that provide better support.
But have we not hit on one of the reasons for the lack of progress of certain cohorts of individuals, is that they muck about in school? I mean, it's bad behaviour that stops good teachers from going to those schools, and that bad behaviour will also prevent those children exhibiting that behaviour from actually getting ahead.
So we need to be clear about the parameters of our research, which is correlated with poverty. So the prevalence of children from poor families, not necessarily behaviour. Now, that can manifest itself in behaviour and other wider social issues.
And just to go back to what we were saying before, I mean, you said that white pupils in general had fallen behind since 2019, but then you you made the claim that it seemed to me that the average is being dragged down from white pupils by working class white pupils. Therefore, it is a working class white pupil problem, not a white pupil problem.
I think that's fair to say. What I was citing is the particular data from our own analysis, but what that suggests is that poverty is a key driver of low education attainment.
And okay, some uncomfortable thoughts now. Bear with me. If given the same educational opportunities, white working class youth perform badly compared to their cohorts, it's a factor of intelligence, perhaps. Maybe they're just not bright enough.
I don't think we can draw that conclusion. What we can look at is the impact of wider family support, the home learning environment, where they're located in the country could matter as well. We know that some areas of the country, there's very little cultural capital. There's often communities with lower aspiration. So it could be a combination of all of those things and not a question of intelligence.
But if the families that these children come from are low attainment families, then is that not possible that the low intelligence is being passed on from parents to child?
It's more likely to be multi-generational poverty rather than low intelligence.
But is the multi-generational poverty a function of low intelligence?
The research doesn't allow me to conclude that that's the case, Nick.
So the Education Secretary has bemoaned the fact that few white working class students get the grades needed for university. Does that imply that they're not suited to university, or is there something else going on?
No, it doesn't imply that at all. What it does suggest is that we need to tackle the issue of low attainment and poverty early on if we want young people, whatever their background, to be able to go on to do well and thrive, whether that's at university or through another route.
And what can practically be done then to specifically target white working class children to help them do better?
So what we want to see from the government's package of reform in the autumn is more investment in high quality early years education so that children from poor families get the best start in life, a better system of support for children with special educational needs, where we know that those from poorer families often aren't identified early enough. As I mentioned earlier, more incentives to get the best teachers to work in the most challenging areas of the country and most challenging schools. And then beyond school, there should be more funding targeted to disadvantaged 16 to 19 year olds, and an increase in maintenance loans for students once they're in university or higher education, and for those loans to be maintained in real terms, because that will help young people from poorer backgrounds when they get to university to be able to stay there.
It's quite a thought for somebody who comes from a poorer household, though, to take on all of that debt. I mean, loans is something that I never had to deal with when I went to university. It used to be free, and they gave you money on top. So there's a double hurdle, isn't there, for poorer students to get over. They have to outperform their peers, and they have to find a way to afford university if they manage to get in. As I said, it used to be free with a grant on top. It still is free in Scotland, considerably cheaper in Europe. For the benefit of the nation's future, why can't university education be free in England and Wales?
Well, that's a question for the Exchequer about whether it wants to, you know, whether it wants to put money back into student, into maintenance grants. But what we do know is that young people don't start to pay back their student loan until they are earning over a certain amount. So the system overall is more progressive, but in terms of maintenance, that is something that the government needs to look at. We know, for example, that the cost of student housing has increased, and even the highest value loan doesn't cover the average cost of student accommodation.
So what some students are doing is what's quite common in America, is they're working while they're studying. Do you have any thoughts on whether you can actually do two things at once, where you can study for a degree and have a job in order to fund your lifestyle?
Well, we know that lots of students do have part-time jobs while they're studying. But what we're also seeing is that some students are actually taking 1 or 2 years out in order to work and save money before they start university. And that seems to be an increasing trend too.
And I read that UCAS, the College Admissions Service, they say they're concerned about the number of students who opt to study close to their parents or remain in the parents' home. You know, for money reasons. Is that something to be worried about?
I think we should be worried about it from a perspective of fairness and opportunity for all. Young people shouldn't feel obliged or compelled to stay at home for financial reasons. Maybe they're staying at home if they've got caring responsibilities, but they should certainly have the same opportunity to go to a university that suits them, and funding or finances shouldn't be a burden or a barrier to that.
Now, your organisation has called for the government to publish its child poverty strategy.
Yeah.
Aside of the things that we've already been talking about, what would you like to see in that?
I think one of the most important things that the government needs to do in the forthcoming strategy is to reverse the two-child benefit cap.
Right. Anything other than that?
I think we need to see policies related to better and more secure housing. We know that particularly in the capital, there's a prevalence of poor quality, unsafe housing. And that's undoubtedly having an effect on children's health, well-being and educational outcomes. And the other thing that needs to be tackled is food poverty and the cost of food, particularly, again, in the early years where that early nutrition is really important.
Very good to talk to you, Natalie. Thanks very much for your time. That's Pereira, CEO of the Education Policy Institute. And as you heard, her research found that since 2019, all other ethnicities have made better progress than white British pupils. Now, that's an odd finding, isn't it? Why on earth would that be? And other thoughts about this. Why do white working class students do so particularly badly at school? And if we concentrate efforts on a particular demographic, as some would suggest, in order to try and make white working class students do better, won't that mean that there will be fewer resources for other demographic groups? It's sort of amounts to a sort of social engineering. What do you make of this? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone. 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
This is LBC.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
But 9.13% fixed annual return with Cufflink. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest, property-backed from £500. Hard not to agree. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to auto-invest and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA. Visit cufflink.com for full T's and C's.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you? Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, has pledged to tackle what she called the thorny generational challenge of British white working class young people falling behind their peers. She called it her priority for the year ahead. So why do they, then? I mean, if they go to the same school in the same town and they get the same teachers in the same classroom, then why do specifically white working class young people do so very badly compared to everybody else who is sitting around them in that class? Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, said it was a national disgrace that so many young people were written off and do not get what they need in the education system to achieve and thrive after leaving school. And that for many young people, particularly those white working class British students, they don't get the exam results that they need to allow them to continue on to university. So what do you think is going on here? And if you've taught in school, then I'd be particularly interested in hearing from you. 0345 6060 973. Bristol, Neil.
Hi, Nick. Yeah, I've just been listening to that lady who was speaking before. She just kind of wound me up a bit. She was just talking stats and it was talked like a civil servant, really. She'd clearly never been anywhere near a child.
I'm not sure that's entirely fair, but anyway.
No, but, you know. It's not to do with the working class or anything like that. It's to do with... I've never taught in a school, but I've been working in preschool childcare for 20 odd years, just retired, and I'm just fed up with this nonsense. It's it's parents who are just not doing what they should be doing with their children and then just bundling them off to a nursery and hoping that they can get them to make them better somehow. But you know, there's no discipline nowadays. Nobody's allowed to say no to children. You know, this is what the problem is. It all starts really early on, and then by the time they get to school, you know, primary school, secondary school, it's too late, mate. You know, it's nothing to do with class. It's just to do with the parents and what they, how they bring their children up. Because my children are good. I mean, I'm not working class, but you know, lower middle class probably.
It's an uncomfortable thing to say out loud, but it is a bit to do with class, isn't it? Behaviour. I mean, for instance, if you go to a football match, then you will get a different type of crowd and a different sort of behaviour than you would at, for instance, a cricket match or the tennis.
I don't know. I've seen some fights at cricket matches, but anyway, I take your broad point.
Right.
So
you were experiencing this at preschool. So there are parents who you can see, even at that age, that they aren't really helping as far as their children are concerned.
No. And the thing is, the whole education system is broken. But I can only speak from the preschool stuff. Mm. You know.
It's broken?
It's because, you know, parents, you know, it's very expensive for a start. I don't know why it should be so much, but that's another story. But then, you know, you're handing your children over, your very young children over, in some cases babies, to, you know, girls who are about 20 years old, never, no experience whatsoever of working, you know, of having children of their own or even, you know, and they just don't know what they're doing, really. And I'm not blaming them. It's just that's the system. You know, we need to have a system where there's more, you know, older people, not old like me, but, you know, people who are more experienced with working and actually know what they're doing with children and can actually say, and then be given the freedom to actually say, no, you can say no. You know, parents are nowadays just, they're so scared of saying no to their children. And you see so many, I've worked in lots of different nurseries. I work for agencies. And, you know, even in, like, rich places, like in Bath, you know, they're just spoiled brats, half of them, you know. You know, and they just got no idea, you know. And they just laugh at you if you tell them off, you know.
And presumably that would carry, that kind of behaviour would then carry through to, you know, regular school. To the detriment of not just the people who are exhibiting that behaviour, but everyone who's sitting around them, who are going to be dragged down by them.
Exactly.
Interesting. Thanks for that, Neil. 0345 6060 973. Susie says, it's nothing new that children of other ethnicities are ahead of British white children. Some mothers have always been encouraged by the parents to study. It's that that is very rarely the case in the white British child, said Susie. Milton Keynes, Vanessa.
Hello there. Hi, Nick.
Vanessa.
I've been a teacher for probably 30 years. I'm retired now. And I think one of the things that was very noticeable is that some cultures, particularly families that have come over to this country, have very high expectations and high hopes for their children, and they take their education very seriously. They do a lot of work with them at home, and I think that a lot of families, particularly noticeable ones that don't have very many books at home, don't think about too much about reading in the evenings with them, and just have a love of books, actually, do tend to fall behind for a while. Because once you have literacy and you've got a grasp on that, then you've got a kind of window to all the other interests that there are in the world, you know, whether it's history or geography or dinosaurs or football or whatever.
Well, so it's, and I'm going to say uncomfortable things again, I can't avoid it with this conversation, but is a shorthand way of saying what you just said, that intelligent parents breed intelligent children?
No, I don't think they have to be intelligent. I think they have to be interested in their child's education and see how important it is.
But is it more? Is it not more likely that an intelligent person of education will be more interested in their child's education? And if somebody who, as opposed to a parent who achieved nothing in school, because they could, you know, for whatever reason, probably, you know, it could be that they couldn't keep up, or they weren't interested, or they were too busy mucking about, or whatever. If they weren't interested in their own education, then they won't pass an interest on to their child for their education.
I suppose that is true. I'd have to agree with that, yeah.
And that's the generational issue, isn't it? That one generation passes on a lack of interest or a lack of intelligence, however you want to describe it, to their children, and their children will grow up and then have children, and they will pass that lack of interest on to their children, and that's why families stay, you know, at the bottom of the pile.
Yeah, but I think if people realised, I think sometimes it's just too late. And of course, people who have less money, it could be argued that they may be working longer and have less time.
But it's interesting that you started this conversation by saying that those people who had come here from, you know, other countries, they have a vested interest in getting their children getting ahead, and they really impose that desire on their children and help them to succeed. So it's not really a money thing, because presumably, immigrant families aren't necessarily rich. They're probably at least as poor as the, you know, white working class families.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there are certain cultures that have stood out as, they always read at home with their kids. They always make sure, they check with the teacher. They come to all the parents' evenings and all that kind of thing. They're constantly concerned about how their children are getting on. And I think that, I mean, that isn't the same for all white people, or all English people, or all British people, but that they don't. But I think there is definitely, I think it's always one of those things that we try as teachers when we speak to parents to say how important it is. Because once they've got that sort of grasp on an enjoyment of reading, and it's a tricky thing to learn, you know, it's hard to sort of decipher these little squiggles on a page. It's a lot of effort, you know.
Well, particularly if you're used to, these days, the constant mental stimulus of colourful screens with their bings and their bongs and, you know, this
well,
constant
that's true.
Call
but, I mean,
for
even
attention.
Even those have got words on, you know, even those have got words. It's just a word thing. I think it's the enjoyment of it. It's the whole. And also, of course, a lot of stories which are about our culture as well, you know, the fairy tales and the traditional tales that, if they learn those or understand them and read them at an early age, I'm just really advocating that we have libraries. And I know when my kids were little, I used to go take them to the library every few weeks, and they'd take out 10 books and bring them home, you know? And they'd pick whatever they liked. They could pick comics or whatever was in the library, basically. It's just fostering a love of understanding that to start with.
Yes.
And then they've got a whole range of other subjects open to them as soon as they can read.
Yes, a love of reading and a curiosity. Fostering a curiosity is vital. Good to talk to you, Vanessa. I'm going to take a short break for the news. Still to come on this show, we're going to cross over to our US correspondent, but more of your thoughts about what we're talking about here. Why do specifically white working class kids do so very badly in school, to the point that the education secretary has called it reversing that trend her priority for the year ahead? 0345 6060 973. Just past 12:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The broadcaster Al Jazeera is accusing the Israeli military of murdering one of its journalists and four other colleagues in Gaza. It says Anas al-Sharif was killed in Gaza City and had been heading a Hamas cell. It's being reported the drink drive limit could be reduced as part of a new government attempt to reduce the number of road deaths. Tougher penalties for driving without insurance and failing to wear a seatbelt are due to be considered as well. And a man has been charged with murdering a father and son following a stabbing at theatre business in London. Two other men were treated for stab wounds after being found in Bermondsey at the end of last month. LBC weather mostly clear overnight with some mist and fog developing. Rain will move across Northern Ireland, Scotland and Northern England and we'll see a low of 13 degrees.
This is LBC.
Psst, have you heard?
About what?
About Boots Optician's ultimate eye test with OptiMap scan.
Why are you whispering?
I think it's for VIPs. It's an in-depth look into your eye that can detect health conditions that other eye scans might miss.
You know, the whole family's already had one done. You should too.
Okay, I'll book one now.
Why are you still whispering?
Don't know. Can't seem to stop.
Ask about OptiMap when you book an eye test at Boots Opticians and see what's possible. OptiMap available in selected stores. Additional charges apply.
Julie could part exchange her car. Or check out We Buy Any Car. She could be unsure if she got a good deal part exchanging. Or have cash in the bank with more bargaining power to get a bigger car for her five-a-side team. Totally played. Or total player. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We're talking about what the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, called a thorny generational challenge of British white working class young people falling behind their peers. Basically not doing well in school with everything that comes from that. Claire in York says, it really puts paid to the argument from some that ethnic communities and immigrants are a negative influence on our communities. It appears it's feckless white parents which aren't involving themselves sufficiently in their kids' education. Tavistock. Hello, Rose.
Hello, Nick. Now, listen, I think that this attitude that it's... Sorry, I'm speechless. Intelligence is necessarily passed down through the family is extremely pernicious, and I suggest you read The Soul of Man Under Socialism by Oscar Wilde, which I was recommended by my 19-year-old nephew at the time after I told him my father's story. I have mentioned my father before. And I would like first to say that we have an invidious thing in this country called the class system, by which working class people are inculcated with the idea that culture is not for them, advancing is not for them, intelligence and intellect is not for them. Now, you have to nurture intelligence for it to blossom. My father was exceptional. How many people in his very poor working class environment were not exceptional but highly intelligent? My nana had to work, work, work. She had no time to read, she had no time to go to the library, and they most certainly could not afford books. He became a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1970-something, which is the thing where all the brilliant scientists are, and they have FRS after their name. So all these people that you admire who know about climate change and stuff like that, he's not one of those, he's a biochemist, they will belong to that society.
Yeah, but you can pick out instances but those instances don't disprove generalities or averages, do they? I mean, is it not likely that a less intelligent pair of parents will pass on that lack of intelligence to their children, just as tall parents pass on height to their children and blonde parents pass on blonde hair?
Well, to some extent, but the thing is that it's the society is so weighted against intelligence being nurtured if it is in a working class child. I mean, particularly at the time of my father. But I mean, this would not have happened to him had it not been for Mr. White, who was his teacher at school, obviously an unusually, you know, exceptional teacher, who said to Nana, look, we need to do something about this lad. You know, and you could then go to night school,
yes,
free of charge, which he was able to do.
Right.
But even then, it was an exception. You know, he was absolutely brilliant. And what my point is that, and his sister was bright too, my Auntie Jean.
Well, so what you're describing is a family of intelligent people.
Well, there was no evidence that Nana was intelligent, no.
You just said so.
No.
I thought that's precisely what you just said.
No, I didn't say Nana was my grandma, my auntie, Jean.
Right, well, okay, well, I'm getting mixed up with the genealogy here, but...
I think
overall,
it's absolutely appalling. You know, this is the whole problem, that is the view that has been taken all along. Well, they're born poor, they must be sick. Let's leave them there. You know, it's absolutely disgusting, and I just keep thinking of all the kids in my father's environment who were nothing like as exceptional as him.
Right, but it doesn't get...
enough to want to use their brain,
okay.
But no opportunity.
All right, but opportunity is available to a class of students equally. If you are in a class of, say, 30 kids, and, you know, it's made up of all of the different classes, then the suggestion that some people do badly because of their class just doesn't really wash. I mean, they might do badly because they didn't have a good meal that morning, but that's a separate but related issue. If they don't do well, surely they have to take some responsibility for their own actions. They probably don't do well because of their behaviour. They're not paying attention. They don't care about being in school, and they're looking out the window and they're flicking spitballs at each other.
Well, supposing they have nowhere to do their homework at home, supposing they're being beaten up by one of their parents, there's all sorts of things going on.
Right, well, that could, you know, the beating up of the parents, that could apply to somebody from any class, and not having a place to work at home, well, that is an issue, but that's surely not the case with all working class people. And we're talking about averages here, so why is it that white working class people do badly? And I can't imagine that it's because that society has told them that they're not worth anything.
Can't you? I can.
Right.
And I'd suggest you read The Soul of Man and Socialism by Oscar Wilde.
Well,
that sounds
like homework, Rose.
Well, that's probably the problem. You didn't do it.
That's exactly right, which is why I have failed upwards to the position that I now hold. Appreciate that, Rose. Thanks for that. Rashpool, Chiswick.
Yes, hello to you, Mr. Chair. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I want to put in, because my research, I'm at present student of legal practice course, and for my master's I had to carry out a research, The Fault Lies with Social Housing. The majority of so-called white live in social housing, and the social housing is very poor. Government is very good at making laws. I did a research on Section 8 and 10 of the Landlord and Tenant Act 85, and the government brought in Homes Fitness for Human Habitation in 2018. That quite clearly states that the housing where majority of people in this country live is extremely poor. On the contrary, the children from Chinese and Indians live in private housing. And that is the main reason. I did the advice in my paper that how we can overcome that. But of course, nobody listens. And when those who suffer go to legal aid, there's no legal aid. And the culprits are conservatives. They have deliberately kept working class people low so they can create divide and rule policy. They want more people like bees producing honey for them.
Well, can you give us a précis of your conclusion then? Well, how can we fix that problem?
Well, I proposed that what they should do is, I'm reading off my paper now, if you allow me 1 minute, that the government should make cab rank system. In other words, when a tenant suffers from bad housing, he should be able to go to a solicitor, and the solicitor should accept the instructions, take the local authority by the scruff to the magistrate courts, to the local authority courts, to the county courts, establish, set up different courts where the judges know what is the problem with housing.
Right.
But nobody listens.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a very specific housing issue, which is related to what we're talking about, but it isn't really the it of it. But I appreciate that, Rashbull. Thank you. Winnersh. Hello, David.
Hello there. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Right. Well, I've just finished work as a builder at Heathrow Airport. I'm a 59-year-old white working-class bloke. Now, trying to cut a long story short, my mother, who's still alive, she lives next door to me now, she's downsized. She was from a very affluent background. My grandparents, I'm the eldest grandson. Now, my granddad used to tell me off the way he used to speak. They used to both speak with very posh voices. He was the lead bassoonist in the London Philharmonic Orchestra. He was the best bassoon player in this world. My grandmother, she was called Granny. She was an oboe teacher at Croydon. They had three daughters. One was Diana, head of the English degree paper at Cambridge, lived in Italy all her life, going out to see where she used to live. She went to university, spoke Italian, French, German, Russian. Very intelligent woman. My Diana, who's still alive, my mum's sister, a great artist, speaks different languages. My mum, I love her dearly, but she gave me nothing, not a brain cell. So I work as a builder at Heathrow. Now, I remember going to my grandparents in Ealing. They had a music room, a piano, music, teaching people, very affluent people. They spoke with very posh voices, but I don't feel ill harmed at 59. I just think to myself, why didn't any of the brain cells come down to me?
Well, is it possible that they did? It's just
no,
that,
they haven't.
They haven't, right.
No, but bang some nails into a piece of wood, build a plasterboard wall, decorate a wall.
Mm.
That's as far as it goes. But the opportunities were there. I remember going to see my grandfather at the Royal College of Music in London, a very posh, affluent college. My great-great-grandfather was one of the founder members of the Royal College of Music. I did know nothing of this. I was brought up in a Bradford Trust house in Hayes. My mum had two kids. She had dead-end jobs all her life. She's still alive. But yes, my grandparents were very, very professional, upper-class people.
Mm.
And I remember, was it Michael J. Fox?
Well, the actor.
My grandfather taught his father the bassoon. Then my grandfather also taught the French bassoon, which was a dying breed back then.
Right, okay.
I didn't realise how important this guy was, but what I would like to say to you is,
yes,
people moan about class, but look, I'm a 59-and-a-half-year-old working-class man. I've not had a bad life, but yes, you know, very interesting people, and yeah, but the brain cells never went down to me. But I think it's down to children working hard. I've got three kids.
Working hard helps, yes. Luck is probably the thing that affects most people's lives the most. But working hard will help. Yeah, David, thanks for that. Got to go. I'm running out of time. 034... Oh, no, there's no point in giving the number because I'm going to jaunt over to America after this break. We're going to talk to our LBC US correspondent, Simon Marks, about what has been going on there. This is LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
The government is now to deport foreign criminals to free up prison space in its latest offensive against migrant wrongdoers who might not then face jail in their home country. But do you believe that's fair?
Richard Spur on LBC.
You're driving down the back roads of Tuscany. The sun's setting, the wind's in your hair. You're playing your favourite tunes. No, not that one. Much better. Could life be any sweeter? Of course it can. With the money you saved by comparing car hire prices through Kayak, you've got more to spend on some fresh, creamy gelato. Mmm, we'll take 2 scoops, per favore. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
But 9.13% fixed annual return with Cufflink. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Hard not to agree. Visit cufflink.com. That's Cufflink. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to auto-invest and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA. Visit cufflink.com for full T's and C's.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Squid Game, Dad.
Let's watch it together this weekend. That'd be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
Four. That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV, plus change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary, terms apply.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
To America now to talk to LBC's US correspondent Simon Marks, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
Now, we haven't spoken for many months.
I know.
Absolutely nothing has happened in the intervening
nothing
period.
Has happened. No. Nothing at all. Nothing at all.
There's a
but
big
we've got
thing.
A big week coming up.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Next Friday. What do you know?
Well, Friday appears to be the day that we're going to see Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin meeting in, of all places, Alaska, which is a bit of a surprise as the chosen venue, not least because it has been fully a decade since Vladimir Putin was last allowed to set foot on American soil, and then he was only over for a meeting of the UN General Assembly. But Barack Obama had a quick chat with him on the sidelines of that event because it was after the Russians had annexed Crimea, but of course before Vladimir Putin even had the rest of Ukraine, as a glint in his eye. Now Vladimir Putin arrives in the United States, it appears, for a meeting with absolutely no preconditions, even though he is sanctioned to the hilt by the American government, and even though the International Criminal Court, of course, has issued an arrest warrant for him on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Ukraine. So the fact that the American government has decided to do this on U.S. soil, and not just any old American soil, but Alaska, the state that was purchased by the United States from Russia in 1867. That's led to all sorts of Kremlin aides over the weekend describing it as Russian America and talking about deep historic ties that they have to Alaska through the Orthodox Church, through fur traders from Russia whose family then stayed in Alaska after the handover, is being seen here by critics of the Trump administration as an extraordinary give to President Vladimir Putin. Any other past administration would have set a very high bar, even for a face-to-face meeting in a third country, much less one in the United States. But the Trump administration, of course, argues it's also opportunity because they are able to point to Alaska's history and say, look, here's an example of one piece of terrain that changed sovereign hands, moved from Russia to American sovereignty and flourished as a result of that process. They're going to argue that some sort of territorial concessions, Donald Trump says, on the part of both countries, Russia and Ukraine, should equally be seen as some kind of opportunity. Clearly, Volodymyr Zelensky senses a trap.
Yes, with good reason. Now, is there any reason for Trump to have said that about swapping of territory, or is it just one of those things that flits across his mind and then comes out of his mouth?
Well, it was curious the way in which he constructed that proposition, because he actually said, we're going to give some stuff up. And you think, well, who's the we here? Because certainly the we, in his mind, has never been the United States and Volodymyr Zelensky. He's accused the Ukrainians of starting the war on numerous occasions. So we find it's, you know, it's a curious phraseology that he used on Friday when he said that.
Yeah.
Zelensky has spent the entire weekend, of course, talking to the Europeans, saying he's not giving up an inch. And the Europeans, in turn, have said to Donald Trump, you've got to include the Ukrainians in all of this. Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, gave an interview today to ABC. I mean, I say he gave an interview to ABC. It was really a direct appeal to President Trump to hold a tough line with Vladimir Putin. It was clear that the message was intended for an audience of one. But we find ourselves in an extraordinary position. This time last week, Donald Trump was threatening crippling sanctions on Russia, giving them until Friday to end the war in Ukraine, said he'd finally had it with Vladimir Putin. You know, this time it's for real. Mm. And after one brief meeting in the Kremlin between Vladimir Putin and Trump's special envoy and real estate magnate Steve Witkoff, suddenly, Vladimir Putin's calling the tune and coming to Alaska for a conversation that he says is going to be all about improving bilateral relations, not between Russia and Ukraine, but between Russia and the United States.
Yeah. One of the benefits of having it in Alaska is that, you know, Alaska, American territory, and Russia are very, very close. And I believe that from that area of the map, from Russia, you can actually see Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yes. Well, it was Sarah Palin, of course, who once claimed, because she was the governor of Alaska at the time.
Oh, when, I got that wrong. Was going to be that was a good joke. If only I'd got it right. Oh, well.
Marjorie Taylor Greene might believe it too. Who knows?
Can we rewind and do it again?
But she, of course, infamously said that you could, John McCain disastrously selected her to be his running mate, that you could actually see Russia from Alaska, which is not entirely true. They're not even doing it, by the way, at the closest point to Russia. They're doing it, we believe, on the outskirts of Anchorage. I think there is still some doubt about how all this is going to play out and whether it's really, really going to happen. I can tell you that I was saying to colleagues today, if we're going to go, we better make sure the air tickets are fully refundable, because anything could happen.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Donald Trump saw something he didn't like on the way to one of his golf outings, and that was homeless people, and now he's decided to get rid of them.
Yes, we've got a very big day dawning Monday here in Washington, D.C., because the President of the United States is going to be making some kind of a speech or a presentation in which he's going to go after Washington, D.C., the city. And particularly, he says, he's determined to clear the homeless off the streets and cart them out and deposit them, as he puts it, a long way away from the Capitol. But he's also fulminating about violent crime here. And even though the crime statistics are down, the reason why he's particularly fulminating about it is because a former member of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency got very badly mugged here, along with his partner, about 10 days ago in a carjacking by a group of teenagers. And we are seeing an enormous number of carjackings in the center of the city here in Washington. There's no question that that situation has deteriorated. So Donald Trump has got the bit between his teeth about trying to clear the city of violence, crime, and homelessness. There's no indication that the carjackers, by the way, were homeless at all. A couple of teenagers have been charged in connection with it. Mm. But the bigger story here is that what Donald Trump covets is the federal government's takeover of Washington, D.C. Remember, Washington, D.C. is not a state. It's a city that has a significant budget of its own. The city council here oversees $21 billion in tax revenues and budget every year. But the city has to get congressional approval for the way in which it spends much of that money. And what Donald Trump appears to be threatening now is a full-scale federal takeover of this Democratic Party-run stronghold and city. And if that's what he's going to talk about tomorrow, I mean, we don't even know under what authority he thinks he's got the capacity to start clearing homeless people off the streets of Washington, D.C. That's a separate conversation. But if he goes further even than that, there's going to be a massive storm here breaking tomorrow.
Huh. And to be clear, the crime rate in Washington is at a 30-year low, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, indeed. Absolutely. It's substantially fallen under the aegis of Mayor Muriel Bowser, a Democrat. She has played a game of trying to get close to Donald Trump, and it's largely succeeded. She's been at the White House for several events. She has spoken warmly of him for many residents of Washington, D.C., a little bit too warmly of him, but she's been trying to stave off this threat of a federal government takeover of the city, which would have astonishing repercussions, depending on how far it goes. But, you know, not just crime and violence in the city. They could take over the school system. They could go through the school's curriculum with a dose of salts. They could take over the DC jail. I mean, all sorts of areas of government that is locally overseen here could fall away very, very quickly. And of course, one of the reasons why he covets it is because it is a Democratic Party stronghold. And so the capacity for him to try and sort of smash that or at least derail it politically is not uninteresting to him.
And finally, his pettiness knows no bounds. He is an interior designer, you know, along with his many other qualities, and he has interiorly designed redesigned the Oval Office by putting golden cherubs on every vertical surface that look at about as cheap as what you'd get in a Christmas cracker. And he's now moving paintings. What's the story there?
Yep, three paintings have been moved. The official portraits of former Presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and George H. W. Bush. According to reports today, they have suddenly been moved from their place of honor in the White House and deposited in a back stairwell. And all of them have been replaced, again, according to the reports that we've seen here this evening, by imagery of one President Donald J. Trump. This on top of the fact that he's completely paved over Jackie Kennedy's Rose Garden and turned it into a courtyard that looks eerily like the one where he has his Sunday brunch at Mar-a-Lago.
Yes.
They're now building a 90,000 square foot ballroom somewhere on the White House complex that the building absolutely doesn't need, and the aforementioned gold molding on every surface in every nook and cranny. And it, you know, never mind what he's doing to the country. In the event that a Democrat gets back into the Oval Office, just undoing that lot is going to take an enormous amount of effort.
An enormous amount of white paint. Yes. Good to talk to you, Simon.
And to you, Nick. Take care, mate.
Simon Marks, LBC's US correspondent, joining us there from Washington, D.C. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on both Global Player and the new LBC app. Both are free. Get them from your app store. The LBC app has news that you can read and watch, the latest from LBC. And with the news, you can put the categories of it in the order that you want. You can pause and rewind live radio with that. And you can listen to a boatload of podcasts, many of which are by me. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Morning. Still to come after the Homelessness Minister, Roshanara Ali, resigned after telling her East London tenants to leave as she was selling her home. I'll be asking if you think it's right that MPs should make money from being private landlords or indeed having any second job of any kind. But first, the UK is soon to begin deporting foreign criminals in order to free up prison space in what's been described as the government's latest crackdown on migration. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said the non-British offenders would be sent packing as soon as they received a custodial sentence. So this morning, do you support the policy which potentially could mean that people from overseas who've broken the law in this country might not face justice when they return to their homeland, despite having committed a crime in Britain? 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
from Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. The Israeli military says it's killed a journalist who was working for Al Jazeera in a strike on Gaza City. It's accused Anas al-Sharif of heading a Hamas cell. The Qatari-based broadcaster is tonight accusing the IDF of murdering him and four other colleagues. Ahmed Najjar is a Palestinian political analyst who's been talking to LBC.
He was reporting from the north of Gaza when no one actually dared to report from there because Israel was targeting journalists from there. He was threatened personally, as he announced in his social media, by the Israeli army that they will kill him, and sadly they just managed to do that.
Officials in Turkey say the northwest of the country has been struck by a large earthquake. It carried a magnitude of 6.1 and numerous aftershocks are being reported. The Education Secretary is promising to tackle the issue of white British young people from working-class backgrounds falling behind at school. Bridget Phillipson says it will be her priority for the year ahead, and there's a stark attainment gap between different demographics. Natalie Pereira from the Education Policy Institute has been telling LBC the assertion is partly right.
We know that since 2019, pupils from all other ethnicities have, on average, made better progress than white British pupils. But they're not the only group that we should be concerned about. There are still other ethnic groups that are still performing less well than white British pupils.
A large plume of smoke's been developing over Edinburgh because of a wildfire on Arthur's Seat. Police are asking walkers and motorists to avoid the area, which overlooks the city. And a yellow alert for heat is due to be applied to large parts of England later on today. It will cover an area from the southwest up to Yorkshire after the Met Office warned temperatures could surpass 30 degrees in some places. The forecaster Jim Dale has been telling LBC the weather will affect most of this week.
The heat wave starts today and it moves through Tuesday and Wednesday and in the east on Thursday. So it's a four-day event. It has to be 3 days to be called a heat wave officially. The high so far this year, 35.8, Faversham and Kent. Will we beat that? I think there is a chance.
LBC weather mostly clear overnight with some mist and fog patches developing in places. Rain will move across Northern Ireland, Scotland and parts of the far north of England. We'll see a low in some areas of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Richard Spur.
Hello, good morning. The UK is now set to deport foreign criminals to free up prison space in the government's latest immigration crackdown. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, vowed that the offenders would be sent packing immediately when they received a custodial sentence. The proposed law change, which could save you as a taxpayer an average of £54,000 per year, well, I say you as a taxpayer, we're talking more generally there, it would apply to prisoners serving fixed-term determinate sentences. Authorities would also retain their power not to deport a criminal, but instead just keep them in custody. For example, if the offender was planning further crimes, it was found, against the UK's interests or national security. Our message is clear, said the Justice Secretary. If you abuse our hospitality and break our laws, we will send you packing. She said deportations are up under this government, and with this new law, they will happen earlier than ever before. Almost 5,200 foreign national offenders have been deported since July 2024. That's a 14% increase on the 12 months up to that. This morning, I would like to know whether you feel it is correct to deport foreign criminals to free up prison space in this country, in this latest offensive against migrant wrongdoers, in order that they might be sent back to their home country where they may not face jail, having said that they have committed a crime in this country. 0345 6060973. Well, John Vine, CBE, former UK Independence Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration between 2008 and 2014, spoke to Claire Foges on LBC.
Well, at the moment, it was 50% into the sentence, then they could be considered for deportation. But there was a little known sort of rule change in June this year, which the government made, which means that they can now be considered for deportation at 30% of the sentence. And what's been announced today by the government is that they're going to bring in an amendment to the bill that's going through Parliament at the moment, on immigration to reduce that to zero. So the power will apparently be with the prison governor, once the person's been convicted, to actually arrange deportation of the prisoner back to their country of origin. That's, of course, if that country of origin can be identified and they agree to, presumably, the return of the individual.
So let's be clear at what's at stake here. This is, you know, people who have come to this country from overseas, committed a crime in Britain and have been convicted of doing so, sentenced to a period in jail, would, instead of going to prison in Britain in order to free up space in our prisons, be deported to their home country, which is in itself a relatively expensive process. When they go back to their home country, they may not face a jail sentence there, despite having broken the law in Britain. Is that fair? Is that justice? Think of the victims of their crime in this country, knowing that they have simply been sent home scot-free, potentially. Yes, it will help the overcrowding situation in British jails, but is it fair on the victims? Is it British justice? 0345 6060973. And just to give you some context, record numbers of foreign sex offenders and violent criminals are being held currently in jails in England and Wales. This is according to the first official data by nationality, and we spoke about this last week, you know, an effective league table of which nationalities, foreign nationalities, commit which crimes. Nearly 1,800 foreign national sex offenders were in prison as of June this year. that's up by 10% in the last year. That rate of increase was nearly three times that of Britons, Indigenous Brits, with the number in prison for sex offenders up by nearly 4%. So it is a significant figure. The potential, then, is that these individuals might be sent back to their home country, if it can be identified, but not face jail. Do you feel that that is fair? Well, David Shipley, former HMP Wandsworth inmate, who now writes and speaks about prison issues, spoke to my colleague Ben Kentish.
Yeah, I think it's a popular idea, and it shows that the Justice Secretary, I think, gets it in some ways more than some other members of the government. The theory here is that when foreign nationals get sentenced, the deportation order will immediately begin at that point, and then once they've served a third of their sentence, the state will look to deport them. It won't change any of the legal challenges that people have access to, though, and I think this is the key thing, that you know, you can make a claim on the basis of a right to family life, for example, to block being deported after a sentence, and all of that will still go on. I think it might free up some spaces, and that's, you know, that there isn't one silver bullet. And you look at all the changes that are coming with the sentencing review and the courts review and this. It's just about trying to buy another 500 places or another 1,000 places. And I think, you know, deporting foreign nationals will be popular. They obviously have fewer supporters here in the UK, so it'll be maybe an easier one to do. There is a bit of a risk, though, in that you mentioned the idea you might just deport people straight away. The risk, if we immediately deport to some countries when people are convicted of crimes, they might not get punished at all. Yes. And we might create a situation where essentially you can come to the UK and do crime for no risk at all.
Which to me seems to be one of the major problems with this, that we cannot guarantee that if we send someone back to a country where perhaps the law that they've broken isn't a law in that country, or they're just more lax about it, or there's corruption, or they don't have the prison spaces, or whatever, then yes, the victims will know that the person who abused them or did whatever they did against them is no longer in Britain. But they might also know that they are walking free, having a wonderful life wherever it is they came from. And that's not really justice.
Well, it's not. And I remember actually